Blog Talk Radio.
I have no idea. Well, I don't show any. Oh, now it's coming. I show no idea. I don't know what happened. Please don't ask me. I haven't the slightest idea why we could not see or hear anything.
The ghost in the radio.
We were on the air, but we were operating in the blind. Well, this is September 12, 2014, and this is The Last Word with Michael Lawson. And we have our distinguished guest host, Mr. Bernard Rowe, who is vice president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg chapter of the North Carolina Black Leadership Caucus. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Lawson. How are you, sir?
Well, you see, I played the Temptations because I wanted to lead in to a very special person who is back in the news. And how come I don't show her up here? Where is she at? Oh, there she is. She's back in the news, ladies and gentlemen. And she's back in the news with her whole freaking family.
Hey.
So let's just hear a little from you-know-who.
In the headlines this morning with reports of a bloody brawl involving the former vice presidential candidate and her family at a house party in Anchorage. ABC's Paula Ferris has what we know.
This morning, Sarah Palin and her family at the center of a lively party erupting into a fight. Bristol Palin allegedly throwing a right hook.
Bristol just reached back and started clocking him, and she hit him, you know, reached way back here and caught him right in the chin, like, you know, I counted at least six times.
Eric Thompson says he was one of 70 guests at a birthday party in Anchorage on Saturday. According to political blogger Amanda Coyne, Palin, along with her husband Todd and kids Bristol, Willow, and Track, arriving in a stretch Hummer. Coyne also reporting that as the beer started flowing, that's when the fighting started.
They were knocking his head back, and he was straightening his head back up, and he'd get hit again. And
the Palin family was asked to leave the party after Track Palin allegedly attacked another party guest who had previously dated his younger sister, Willow. That's when the 21-year-old's father stepped in to break up the fight. Once the fight was broken up, the former vice presidential candidate and her family left.
I heard Sarah Palin scream out, "You know who we are, don't you?" It was like we were just on a Jerry Springer episode.
Anchorage police only telling ABC News that members of the Palin family were indeed attending a party at this home Saturday night when a fight erupted outside.
The police seemed to show up right after they left, you know, asking people questions and wanting to know what was going on. And
overnight, Sarah Palin appeared on Fox News' Hannity show, had Barack Obama listen to the best military advice, but made no mention of the alleged altercation. The Palin family could not be reached for comment. Again, Anchorage police telling ABC News that no charges were pressed the night of the fight, but this is an active, this is an ongoing investigation, George. Yeah.
Well, it's an ongoing saga with Sarah Palin. Ongoing. I just looked at my paperwork here. I'm running out of turning colors here.
I see that.
See it? Yeah, so Sarah Palin is part of the landscape now, and anything she does, good or bad, good, let me bite my tongue. I don't know anything she's done good. Nada. Nothing.
At least not for us, right?
Hey, if she can't make money on it,
she's not going to do it.
She ain't going to do it.
That's it.
So the thing is, I need to hear you. Am I hearing you a little bit? You say something.
Hello.
Yeah, okay, so I guess I'm hearing you now.
Yeah, I'm hearing
you.
Oh,
you're not
hearing
me.
There you go.
Anyway, so the thing is that Sarah Palin and Tag and Peg and Bristol and Forrest and Gump and everybody else, I don't know who's always involved in that family, but hey, there's nothing else to do up in Alaska but drink. Watch the Bears.
And have babies, I imagine.
Hey.
There you go.
That's it. That's it. So we're gonna have Yolanda Trotman on the show today, who is running for district court in Charlotte, North Carolina. Yolanda is a lawyer who would make a fine district court judge. So, and we're going to have some questions, even though she won't be involved in district court judge. I think here in North Carolina, in Charlotte, they have a family court.
Family court.
So anything to do with beating your wife, you wouldn't go to district court.
I guess not.
Suppose he wants, or she wants to appeal it. Where do you go then?
Wouldn't that be the superior court?
Oh, so district court still would see.
No.
Okay.
At least I believe that. We'll find out.
We'll find out from her. Okay. And then we also, hey, did you hear about the Speaker of the House in South Kakalaki? Yes, the Speaker of the House is getting, well, they're asking his butt to resign. Now, there's a major problem here. Because in South Carolina, you can do anything. You can walk the woods. You can walk the mountain trails.
Yeah,
so, it doesn't matter. And you're not asked to resign. But the Speaker of the House has been charged by the – now, he's Republican.
Yeah, of course.
And by a Republican attorney general –
wow.
With over 9 counts.
That's pretty heavy.
Nine counts. And this man, if he's charging this guy with nine counts, there's a major problem down there. So listen to what they're charging him.
I mean, there were those who called the leader of the House, Bobby Harrell, to resign, including the governor and the organization who started the action against him, the South Carolina Policy Council.
Now, it is clear from this indictment that they have evidence that he deliberately misused his campaign funds for his own benefit, not once or twice, but multiple times, to the tune of over $1 million.
After a very public battle with the state attorney general over the allegations, the case was eventually sent to First Circuit Solicitor David Pasco. After his investigation, a Richland County grand jury returned a nine-count indictment, including misconduct in office and using campaign funds for personal use. However, News 19 legal expert Jay Bender says that's not grounds for him to be removed from office.
If you are an officer, except a member of the judicial or legislative branch, and accused of a crime, the governor may remove you from office. For example, the governor removed Jimmy Metz from office when he was indicted recently.
The document says that he paid himself close to $300,000 and $70,000 to pay an administrative assistant at his private company. They also say that he falsely claimed that he used his private plane for legislative events in South Carolina and Florida.
He did more than just mislead. He, according to this indictment, seems to have, in fact, defrauded the public. He lied to law enforcement officers, among other things. And this demonstrates such a clear pattern of deliberately hiding the nature of his expenses.
Speaker Harrell released a statement saying, in part, "I have said all along, I have never intentionally violated any law. And I still strongly believe that statement to be accurate. In no way have I ever benefited personally or financially from travel reimbursements from my campaign account." There's no word on when Harrell will have his first court appearance. In the Information Center, Stephen Dial, News 19, WLTX.
Now, as a former policeman, when they say, I didn't do it on purpose, I was going 80 in the 30-mile zone.
Still guilty as charged. So if, did I hear right that the feds are not involved? This is just the state of South Carolina.
State guy, right.
Wow, that's pretty heavy for them to come in and do it, huh?
Hey, come on. I mean, and you know, they always put in that, I didn't intentionally, not intentionally defraud the people of South Carolina.
By $300,000?
Well, and he said that he was using his own private plane to do campaign stops. But, and then when the attorney general questioned him, he found out he never used his campaign to do campaign stuff. Now, you can go in there and look up this stuff, too.
Wow.
I'm talking. Anyway, so he lied about that. So if he lied about something that he never was doing and he tried to use that as the excuse, why, look, hey, I wasn't defrauding the public. I could have charged them for when I went out and do campaign stops when I use my own private plane. No, because you're not supposed to use your own personal vehicle.
Indeed.
If you're going to use your own personal vehicle, that's your problem.
Indeed it is.
You can't do it. Hey, because if he wanted to get, he's the Speaker of the House. I am sure Mickey Haley in this corrupt administration down here in South Carolina could have wiggled away to use her plane. Here's the problem I have with this. This man is the Speaker of the House, the third man in line. For them to charge him, there's a major problem here.
And there's more they're not telling us.
Oh, come on. They would not indict the Speaker of the House. Hey, he must be doing it flagrantly that could bring her down.
That's why they had him resign. Wants him to resign.
Yeah, why? He ain't, right. Then this other guy says, "Oh, he don't have to resign." What, are you kidding me?
Right. They don't want the tentacles to reach into the governor's office.
They don't. They want Obama to resign.
Oh, please.
Because he is appointing people to a temporary status when they're out on vacation, and they've taken almost 6 months vacation the House has taken since they have been in office. They have been on vacation almost months. That's how many days this Congress, not the Senate, but the House has taken time off.
Are you talking about Speaker Boehner and his crew?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yes. Speaker Boehner.
Speaker Boehner.
Now, the problem is, what has this man actually done? Because to me, there's something that we're not hearing. Something that we're not hearing. And if we're not hearing it, how come we're not hearing it? Come, we're not hearing anything that this man has done. There's a major problem here. Now, they also, did you hear about this, that the Republican Party, By accident.
Okay.
They told the truth in trying to get Barack Obama to undermine him. It seems that Wednesday, when Obama revealed the strategy for combating the Islamic State and Iraq and Syria, no one knew exactly what it would be. But that's nonsense, because they all get the briefing papers.
Indeed they do.
He had them all, every single senator in who had a command of a committee in his office.
Yes,
and
did.
Told him exactly what he wanted to do. And you know what happened every time they did this? You know, McCain is no longer in charge of anything yet. He lost all his committee chairs.
Really?
Oh, yeah, he's not in charge of anything. Uh-huh. He's just one of the 100.
Isn't he an elder statesman, so they say?
Well, that's one of the problems. He's elder. He's mentally, you know. Anyway, so the thing is that Alzheimer, yes, that's true. He only remembers what happened last week. He doesn't remember what happened now. So the thing was that what he did was that Speaker Boehner and all the chairs of the committees, all the chairs of the committees of the Senate side, all came in and they all got his speech, and he told them exactly what he was going to ask for.
Yes.
But they could not. Once they go into the Oval Office, if they come out and start talking about it, they can be arrested for that.
Right, right.
All right. So they couldn't say. So the thing was that this guy is saying, oh, we did not know about the airstrikes.
Okay, which guy?
They're not saying here.
Oh.
This guy is saying. He says that when Obama revealed the strategy for combating the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, no one knew exactly what it would be. They knew after that. He said, will Obama ask Congress for permission for those strikes, as he did last year when Congress eventually rebuffed him and said no? They cannot afford. See, he put them in a position, Obama. He said, look, I could go and put boots on the ground. I can bomb the hell out of Syria and Iraq because I got 60 days to do that without you saying nothing.
Right.
And they're the ones that passed that law. So you either come with me now or come with me later, because you're going to come with me. See, he now forced them in a position where they have to help him or look bad to the country because of the election coming.
Right.
Say, they wouldn't do this if there was no election year. They wouldn't do this. But this is an election year that they have to win. They want to get that Senate. So they can't look bad that Barack Obama went out there by himself and went out there. Oh, yeah, we'll help you. We'll give you the money. He's asking, this is the second time he's asking for money.
I know that.
So they're not going to now say no, and he's now forced them because he went on TV and did it.
Yes.
He says, I'm asking you for more money. Okay? Even, what's his face? What's the guy that's running for president? His father was in the House. The doctor.
Ron Paul.
Ron Paul is even on his side, and Ron Paul is against fighting anywhere else. He says, oh, yeah, you know, I think we do got to combat and stand in front of ISIS so it doesn't spread. So all these other people are not saying that.
Right.
Yet. So a lot of people would like to stay on the sideline and just say, just bomb the place and tell us about it later. So they can have, we weren't involved in that when it goes down the tube. It's a election year. A lot of Democrats don't know how it would play in their party, and Republicans don't want to change anything. We like the path we're on now, this is Republicans saying. We can denounce it if it goes bad and praise it if it goes well and take credit for it.
Who said this? Is this
This is the census that this reporter is getting when he interviewed, okay? Jack Kingston, as the Times said Kingston other times notes, supports having a vote on airstrike in Syria. Jack Kingston said he supports airstrikes in Syria. But what he was saying is remarkable. Republicans don't want to vote on a force authorization so they can avoid taking a position and criticize the president on the matter after the fact. In many ways, this is the story of Obama's presidency. He can do no right among the Republicans. Better for the GOP to attack him and avoid laying out a coherent agenda. Or, after all, why govern when you can just sit back on the sidelines and score political points?
That's exactly what they do.
And that's what these people are doing. They're sitting on the sidelines and wanting to score political points. So there is a thing that people always do when they don't want to get their hands dirty. They let someone else do it.
All the time.
All the time.
All the time.
Now, we also have this this thing for, the Republicans are saying, oh, you know what? We never, ever, ever called for impeachment.
What?
That's the thing right now. That they never, ever call. Now, here's a problem. They got that numbnut McCain trying to convince everybody that he never said anything about impeachment. He's saying that he never said anything about going after that Obama didn't know what he's doing. He's among a lot of them who had called for Obama's impeachment. A lot of them who had called for his impeachment. Let's see who we got here on the phone. Hello, who's this?
This would be me, Mr. Michael.
This is Thomas Fortenberry.
Hello, Mr. Fortenberry.
Hey.
Hello.
We had a little mistake here at the beginning. I don't know what happened. We had no sound whatsoever. But we were still on the line.
There's always something like that.
Well, there's always
live.
Yeah.
Live radio is fraught with fun.
Absolutely. So what do you think about the efforts to impeach the president?
Well, I mean, it's like, impeachment part 55 or something. They've been trying since he got elected.
Yes, they have.
They will find any excuse. They will never stop. It's what they're trying to do to rev up their rabid base. So it's completely frivolous. The guy's had less scandals and less problems than any president in modern times. So it's just what else can you expect?
Well, see, the thing is, but they never say exactly what he is done to cause impeachment.
He wore a tan suit.
Oh, you're supposed to address.
Well, it all started, Mike. It started with he was elected. That was the first problem.
Yeah, you're right about that. You're right about that.
No.
Right.
The first
thing,
he was black. That's the first thing. He was born black.
Yeah.
So therefore,
yes.
He never do anything right. Because you know how
so what are you saying there? Article 1, did not know his place.
Yeah.
Right. There you have it.
Absolutely. Article 2, refused to know his place.
Yeah.
And Article 3 is he wouldn't get out when he was told to get out.
So, yeah, exactly. Was not intimidated. You know.
Was not intimidated. And walks with a swagger. So here, the congressional members have stated that Obama may have engaged in impeachable offenses and may face removal from office. They rationalize that the impeachment has to include some sort of allegation, and that he's also used the White House to cover up that Benghazi attack. Benghazi, Benghazi.
Yeah, that's the only international kerfluffle they ever can quote. So yes, Benghazi, always Benghazi.
And Benghazi, you know, the secret CIA base that no one in the world was supposed to know about.
They gave up.
That the ambassador over there knew it was a CIA base, that the ambassador was probably a CIA person himself. They ain't saying none of that. They ain't saying that why they didn't have all the soldiers that they have at regular places in the embassies.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't an embassy.
It wasn't, right.
It was not an embassy. It was a CIA base. I mean, so,
right.
You know, they don't really know that.
But you know how they play this game. They've always played this game. They do the same thing with the people down there in Guantanamo. For years, they've called him, tried to say he's somehow weak on terrorism because he's ending the wars. And in that argument, they make this kind of circular argument. You can tell he's weak on terrorism because he's never done anything to handle all those guys. He just leaves them down there indefinitely. And he isn't a finisher like Bush was. He's fumbling around, and they're in limbo. But what they don't say is, you know, he's tried to close it. He's tried to move them. He's tried to send them to other countries, and every time, you know, they blocked him. They blocked the funding. They put a law in that he couldn't move them to any prison in America. You know, so they make their own arguments and then blame him for it. It's just pretty funny.
Well,
but it's the only thing they can do. I mean, come on.
Well, just listen to this. This is what they wanted him to say.
When the U.S. invaded Iraq 11 years ago, the U.S. government made a decision to disband the existing Iraqi army and instead tear that one apart and build a brand new one from scratch. And the U.S. government, U.S. taxpayers have funded that project of building a brand new Iraqi army, arming them and training them. We funded that to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. Remember, that was the whole strategy for why we had to stay so long.
Our military is helping to train Iraqi security forces so that they can defend their people and fight the enemy on their own. Our strategy can be summed up this way. As the Iraqis stand up, we will stand there. And as I remind the folks of Idaho, our strategy can be summed up this way. As the Iraqis stand up, Americans will stand down. And what that means is, as more and more Iraqis take the fight, to the few who want to disrupt the dreams of the many, that the American troops will be able to pull back. Our policy is stand up, stand down. As the Iraqis stand up, we'll stand down.
Okay, yeah, so he wants to be, when the Iraqis stand up, we'll stand down. Well, you mean it took 12 years for those Iraqis to stand up? And here's the thing. If you're walking down the street every day and you get punched in the face by a couple of thugs, then your father or the military leader or the policeman teaching you karate, gives you weapons, gives you the initiative because you didn't know how to fight. And then as soon as the guy comes down the street again by himself, you throw the guns down and run home to mama.
That's what they did.
Now, how long are we supposed to stay and stand up for them?
Well, the Republicans want to get forever.
I mean, how long? And you heard with that. Oh, I'm going to play that bit from the Moomoo in a minute here. From
Mike, to begin with. Yeah. You know, what are you talking about training and remaining? I don't understand what you mean, because I distinctly remember that airplane landed on an aircraft carrier with a massive banner back in, the beginning of 2003. Bush declared victory. Mission accomplished, he said. So I don't even know what he's talking about. The rest didn't happen. It was over. We won. We did it. Everybody came home. We had a parade, right?
Well, yeah. Well, wasn't he... So, in other words, when he...
So what did we accomplish, right?
Let's see. Is that a difficult question or what? Are you trying to be a trick or what? Is that a trick question?
Yeah.
What are we
come on. This is just bunk. We stayed out there. We invaded. We took over their resources. You know, we built some bases around their oil rigs, and then we hung out for 10 years and wasted $2 trillion, but we haven't done anything. We destroyed their entire infrastructure, destroyed their cities, and we destroyed their and dismantled their military and their police. So what do you think will happen to society? I mean,
well, listen, the thing I know is, why do we build the biggest embassy in the entire world in Iraq? What was that all about?
Because it's a beachhead sitting on top of the world's oil reserves. That's what it was from the get-go.
And how many soldiers do we have?
They might as well just call it, you know, Fortress Oil Rig or something.
So you're saying at that embassy, which is the largest in the entire world, has no soldiers in it guarding it?
Sure it does. They have Marines guarding it, not soldiers.
Oh,
Marines.
Right. They got Marines guarding it. So I guess when they count troops, they don't count Marines.
I guess they don't. They're assigned to the president. So
I'm willing to bet you they got 1,000 soldiers over there or more.
Marines.
Marines. And I guess they don't count Marines as soldiers.
Nope, they're not soldiers. They're Marines.
Y'all are missing the whole point. If you remember the, I'll call it the Cheney Doctrine, but it goes back to Dick Armey and all the rest of them back under Reagan. Their big push was to privatize the military. So when you're talking about deploying actual soldiers, Marines, any kind of Army, Navy, Air Force, that's last. That's the last people in. They're standing around in the commissary with the tray being fed by, you know, one of our hired companies. Well, what we're talking about in these embassies, I can almost guarantee you, just like in Libya, are either CIA or flat-out hired black ops, you know, Blackwater mercenaries by the Kabylian.
Right.
And those are the people that are there. That way we can fund, you know, 100,000 guys standing around in there and then say, we've got no men there. We've got 5 Marines, you know, at the front door or whatever. I mean, there's a distinction they draw that is not valid.
We have a caller on the line. Hello, caller. Who's this?
Senator Stan White.
Who is this? Stan.
Senator Stan White, yeah.
Stan White, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
So, I am glad you're calling in. Tell everybody why you are calling in.
Well, I'm running to take the Senate District 1 seat back. I had that seat before and lost it last time by 21 votes. So I'm just calling in to make folks aware that I plan on taking that seat back.
Now, say that one
just
more time.
Just 21 votes.
By 21 votes out of a
87,000 votes were 87,000 votes were cast.
What? Now, who was counting these votes?
Well, you had a lot of different folks, guys.
Who was
anybody
counting
named? Was there anybody there named Chad?
I don't know.
Exactly. And let the people on the listening in the listening airways here say who you're running against. Let them hear.
I'm running against Bill Cook.
Bill Cook. Bill Cook, who has done absolutely, positively nothing in his entire senatorial career. Nothing.
Well,
nothing.
That's
where Stan should be.
Well, I keep hearing that, and I've been to 2 political functions today, and nobody in the 2 counties are at said they don't remember if they've ever seen him in their county, and certainly, I mean, One advantage, or you might advantage or disadvantage, I was born and raised here in District 1 and served on the DOT board for 10 years, so all these counties were in my district, and I got to know a lot of elected folks. And Senator Cook moved in from he worked with a power company in Washington, D.C., and moved to Beaufort County about 5-6 years ago, I think it was now.
And what do you bring, you know, the problem is, how could we go over something that you lost by 21 votes? And I want to stay on this, because this is a major problem with people saying my vote does not count. There is no such thing as your vote does not count.
You are absolutely right. In fact, the next Tuesday after the election, I went to my Rotary Club, and three of my Rotarian friends came up to me and apologized, said, "Stan, we didn't vote because we knew you had it made."
Wow.
They made me feel real good.
Yeah, well, the problem is, why, and see, I go to these people right now. We're in a position in North Carolina for the first time in 125 years that the governor, the House, and the Senate, I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Stan, have been in one party's hands. Well, not one, in the Republican hands. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
So we had, I believe, it's one of the lowest turnouts.
Yep.
In history in North Carolina 2 years ago?
I'm not sure it was the lowest in the history, because the district that I'm in, District 1, had a pretty heavy turnout, I mean, considering the number of registered voters. But they typically do have a good turnout in a presidential and a gubernatorial election year. And certainly there were a lot of folks that turned out. But the bad news for me is that this district typically votes Republican for presidents and governors. So I had a little uphill battle with that issue to begin with. And a lot of people pull the straight R lever. So, you know, that didn't do me well.
Okay, but see, the problem that I have is in the state of North Carolina, it was woefully, I think, like a 15% voter turnout. And how can anybody get elected when you have a 15% turnout? Anybody with any common sense get elected? Because we have a lot of people with no common sense who are in the Senate right now. The problem is that people have felt comfortable. They felt comfortable here in North Carolina for so long. They don't have to turn out. And see, it doesn't matter if you're in a Republican district, because if you're in a Republican district, you still need to turn out, because it's the aggregate that counts.
Right.
And when people don't turn out, you hurt everybody across the board. And in District 1, okay, which it counts, what communities, what counties in District 1? There are
it's,
eight counties, right?
Eight counties. It's the largest geographic district in the state. If I'm in one end of the district and drive to the other end of the district, and if I stay in the district, it takes 3.5 hours.
Wow. And can you tell us what those counties are in the district?
It's Beaufort, Hyde, Dare, Currituck, Camden, Passportank, Perquimans, and Gates.
Okay, and where is that located in the map of North Carolina?
Just as far east as you can go. Dare County is right on the ocean. Currituck County is right on the ocean. Hyde County has Ocracoke that's on the ocean, and then Beaufort is just a little bit inland, and Passportank and Gates are the northern part of the state that joined the Virginia line, and Perquimans is just below Gates County. So it's northeastern North Carolina, all right to the ocean.
Okay, so we're talking about, I'm not familiar with it, and you know, a lot of people probably listen are not familiar with it. Is that close to 95?
No. We're about 2 hours east of 95.
Okay. Uh-huh. All right, so you have the northern side. How close are you to Virginia?
The Passportank and Gates, Passportank, Camden, and Currituck adjoin the Virginia border, and so does Gates. So you got Gates, Passportank, Camden, and Currituck adjoin the Virginia border.
Now, what are some of the things that, and we're not even going to talk about the person that's there right now because he's done nothing, but you remind some of the people about some of the things that you want to see done. And matter of fact, that has to now be recreated because they were already there. This person in office right now has destroyed that. What do you want to bring back to your county?
Well, I want to bring it back to North Carolina, and I want to bring it back to rural North Carolina, particularly because I live in rural North Carolina, and some of the things they've done have just really devastated the ability for us to create jobs. But I'm a former school teacher. When I graduated from college, I taught school for 3 years, so education has always been dear to my heart, and it's a number one priority to me right now. And I would hope that people would look at the smoke and mirrors that have been put out there about education and what they've done. And I'll give you a perfect example. I was in Perquimans County on Sunday and met with a teacher that was the most senior high school teacher there. And with her raise, she gets $184 less than she did before her raise. And so what they have done,
How is that possible?
Well, what they've done is they have taken your longevity pay, which you usually got as one check at the end of the year. They've taken that longevity pay now and taken it basically away. Then they gave you your raise, and they took the difference between the longevity pay and the raise. So if your raise was, I'm just picking a number, $2,000, and your longevity pay was $2,200, you're $200. You're gonna get $200 less than you did before you got your raise because they took away the longevity.
Now, Mike,
that's even the fix. You know, before that, they weren't offering anything. This is the pretend fix that they're offering because they know they're going to lose the election handily if they go in without having done, quote-unquote, something to help teachers. Because even the Republicans, if you look at their polling they've done privately, you know, in the Tillis campaign and everything else, number one issue is education. Number two issue is teacher pay.
Right.
So this is a major deal for them. But they're trying, like he said, smoke and mirrors. They're trying desperately to say, look, what we've done for schools when they really haven't.
But anything. Right.
Well, they actually have not done anything. And some of the things, I mean, they've taken away teachers' aides, taking away money for that. And now what they're saying is, well, we didn't take away that money. We just gave it to the school systems. And it's up to them to decide how they want to spend it. But then they took away money from the school system, and I know it's a terrible scenario, but they've got a choice now. We can turn the lights on, or we can hire a teacher's assistant.
Right.
So they get less money, but they're saying that the decision is up to the individual school districts to make that decision.
Right, but that way they can try to blame the schools for not having a help in the classroom.
Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
Have they frozen the teachers' pay? Is that correct?
Frozen teachers' pay? No, not to my knowledge. What they've done, they have now changed the system where there are four categories. I mean, four time frames where you'll get a raise. So one lady I was talking to the other day has been there 16 years, and she got an $84 raise. She's been there 15 years. Next year, if the system stays in place, you'll get $2,000 because the 16th year is a year where you get additional money. Now, to be perfectly honest, the freshman teachers, the new teachers, did get a raise, and they got a fairly decent raise, and I don't want to take that away from them, but what they have done, they've penalized the more experienced teachers, trying to force them out of the program because they are costing the state more money in salaries and benefits, and where the younger
right.
teachers are not costing as much.
But then anybody with seniority.
Yes, is that a way to get rid of tenure?
Yes. Stan?
Uh-huh.
That's a way to get rid of tenure, right?
No. I think a lot of folks are confused about tenure. Tenure is it's only a certain amount of job security for a teacher, and basically in school systems, they rotate principals around. And if you had a principal in a school and he came to this school and he had two really good teachers in the school he was at in the past, and he said, "I want to bring these teachers over, so I'm going to fire the two teachers that teach that subject in my school," tenure only protects those two teachers that they can be fired, but there's a process. I mean, you have to document where they've done wrong. I mean, people have said, well, teachers don't deserve tenure. Tenure's, you know, I don't have tenure in my job, but you don't change bosses every 2 years either. And it is a form of security, but not to the extent that most people think. And they think once you get tenure, you can't get fired. You can get fired with tenure just as easy as you can get fired, you know, if you don't have tenure, as long as it's documented.
Well, that's here in North Carolina. I mean, it ain't happening in New York or Pennsylvania or California. But the thing that you didn't want to know is they're on a right now the Art Pope governorship, because we know that McCrory's not really the governor. The Art Pope governorship has a $600 million or close to a $600 million hole. Is that correct?
I've heard some numbers like that, but I'll be honest with you, I've been campaigning so hard, I have not kept up with this last budget.
But the thing is, what are they to say? I mean, because that's going to be a major problem with the guy over there, the governor in Christie, because this is the I think it's the second time in less than 4 months that his estate was, the bond was rating was reduced. They're now down to A.
Jersey?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and that's because he's got an $800 million hole again this year. And this is happening in almost every single state that the Republican legislature has and government and governor has taken over. So it's happening here.
Oh, it is happening here. And they've just underestimated, I mean, the revenues have come under their estimation. And certainly part of revenues is created by new jobs, which have not been created. I mean, some people have dropped off the rolls, but it's also created by new industry moving in, which has not happened. And as you know, there was a lot of talk about, well, let's raise the funding for the lottery and sell more lottery
right.
tickets, and we can use that money to pay teachers. So they're willing to gamble on the less fortunate, the people who buy the lottery tickets. They're gambling on them putting in the money to be able to make up some of this hole they're in.
Well, the thing is, the lottery is supposed to go to the education anyway.
Yes, it is.
I mean, so
yes.
If they're stealing from the lottery, that's another major problem.
Well, the lottery doesn't go to education like a lot of us thought it would when the legislation was passed. And I should change that. That's another smoke and mirrors, that I think the lottery money goes to education, but the prior money that went to education, they took away from education. So really education has not benefited as greatly as most of us thought it was going to do because of the lottery system, just because the money has been shifted.
So give us a rundown, as sure you can make it, what you would be involved with when you get back to your position in the Senate?
Well, I mean, certainly I want to be involved in education. I want to be involved in natural resource issues. Senator Cook helped pass some legislation that now gives us the opportunity to be in the largest landfill in the country, bringing in garbage from New York and New Jersey. They lessen the environmental setbacks to not navigable waters, but to SA water, state water. So we have the potential now of having the largest landfill. I'm absolutely dead set against that. But the other issue that really concerns me is what's happening to some of our natural resources. And this fracking issue is about to drive us folks down here on the coast crazy, because what we're talking about, you know, it takes about 8 million gallons of water when you frack a well. Well, that has got chemicals mixed with it, and a lot of it comes back to the surface, and it's got to be disposed of. And they're talking about the easiest place to dispose of that is down at the coast, because the soil is more porous. Well, our aquifers, you know, are pretty close, or are closer to the surface on the coast, and the potential for contaminating our drinking water, I don't think there's anything that weighs higher than the potential of that. So it really concerns me, and I mean, I know you know that they passed some legislation early on that said it was a felony to tell what those chemicals were. And they did back up and change it to a misdemeanor. But what happens now if someone gets whatever, skin burns or something at a well site, and an EMS truck drives up, they have to sign an affidavit that swears that they will not tell what those chemicals are, or they will be convicted of a misdemeanor. Now, how long is it going to take to read that form? And we got a guy over here with skin burns, suffering, or whatever. But first of all, I mean, why has it got to be such a big secret? You know, if we in North Carolina are going to be suffering the consequences from whatever damage happens to our aquifers, and you don't clean up an aquifer like you go out and clean up the, you know, your front lawn. I mean, once it's damaged, it's damaged.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you can't clean up down deep in the earth.
Yeah.
So now, what is the reasoning they gave that you cannot tell what the chemicals are?
Proprietary, proprietary.
They're quoting corporate trade secrets.
Right.
It's something Putin would do. This is still America, right?
That's what I thought.
Well, what they claim, and this is where it's complete bunk, but what they claim is that if competitors can get their secret mix, that they could go in and, you know, use their formulas and frack and do stuff, and, you know, that'd be unfair for their company when they've created this process or done whatever. But the truth is, the process is open information. Everybody uses the same thing. And in other states, it's not illegal, so everybody already knows the chemicals that they use everywhere. Because some states require that they disclose all of them, and then some states where they have a Republican governor in, they've squashed it with a law like this. But the only reason they squash it is because environmental groups and lawsuits can't proceed when you can't disclose what you're suing about, or you can't disclose what the pollution is. That's
well,
the only reason.
You know, but, you know, the fracking, and I was over at the headquarters, Democratic Party headquarters, and Randy Boa gave me a map, and I think it's already posted on my website, but if not, I'm going to post it later. It's unbelievable where this fracking, where they want to frack at. It seems they have, and the reason why it's all the aquifers, because you need the water to frack, and it
right.
goes to like almost every single aquifer in North Carolina. I mean, it's
yep.
unbelievable.
So well, they're going to frack all the shale, poison every aquifer in the entire state, and then sue you if you talk about it when you get the chemical burns and can't drink water.
You know, yeah, and we can sit here and talk all day. I mean, you know, they say it's going to create jobs, but anybody can tell you that knows anything about fracking. It's pretty specialized work, so they're going to bring their own fracking crews with them when they come in. And the geologists are saying throughout the state that they don't think there's enough natural gas there to make it viable for a large company. So what we're going to end up with, in my opinion, this is strictly my opinion, we're going to end up with these small fly-by-night companies. They'll come in and drill a well, won't make any money, declare bankruptcy, pull out and leave all the damage that they've done already there. And, you know, where are you going to find them? How are you going to find them? I mean, if there was...
Well, they're going to get off scot-free.
Yeah, and if there was enough there that a large, reputable company would come in, you know, you'd have a different comfort level, but there's nobody yet expressed an interest because of the quantity of natural gas that they think is there. I mean, the geologists are saying there's not nearly as much as they're telling the public.
So we're not doing fracking. Fracking is not occurring yet in North Carolina.
Not yet. No, it's not. And I mean, we put a moratorium on fracking until the rules were written, and they changed in this last legislation and basically said, we feel sure they're going to write the right rules, so let's go ahead and frack anyway and write the rules as we go.
Well, what besides, which I think is a major, what a major thing, this fracking, what do you think about the episode or the past episode that's going on, Duke Power dumping into our waterways?
I think it's, you know, it's reprehensible that, and I'll be fair, we can't blame all that on the present administration because they've been doing it for a long time. The thing I can blame on them is not doing something about it to get it cleaned up and to force Duke to come up with a solution and for Duke to pay for it and not pass that expense on to the consumer. But it's a problem that it's like a lot of things that all of us have or see, and you ride by it every day and you just don't think about the consequences until something like what happened there happens, and then you say, hey, how in the world did that ever happen? But it has happened, and something needs to be done about it, and something needs to be done, you know, done quickly, because again, that polluted a water system. I mean, I guess it was the Yadkin River, one of them. Yeah.
How can people get involved with your campaign? Give us some way, contact information, website. How can they get involved with your campaign and make sure these 21 votes at least come back?
Well, certainly campaigns have just gotten unbelievably expensive. My dad used to serve in the House, and it used to cost him about $15,000 to $20,000 a year to run a campaign. And I'm not telling you folks anything new, but I mean it's a $500,000 to $600,000 to run a Senate campaign nowadays. And as of right this minute, the Republicans have a lot of money, and my opponent, as of yet, has not spent any. But the Republican caucus has dumped about 8 different mail pieces to the tune of $150,000 in my district, talking about all the good things that he has done. So we're fighting an uphill battle money wise, but we're going to make it. I mean, we're doing everything right, and we've got the best message, and people are convinced that Senator Cook has not done them right in this area, and he's just not familiar with Northeastern North Carolina and familiar with the issues. He's been extremely good at voting along party lines, pretty much straight across the board.
So where can people get in touch with you?
Well, they can email me at stan@stanwhiteforsenate.com, and my Facebook is
going to... On Facebook?
I'm sorry.
What? On Facebook.
Stan White for Senate, for North Carolina Senate.
Okay. Is there a phone number?
There is a phone number. It's 252-441-4429.
And
Another number, 252-256-0194.
Okay. And this is, you've been hearing from Stan White, who is a native of Bear County. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Born and raised here. Still is
born and
here.
Raised.
And he is not for fracking.
That's
of
exactly
any sort.
Right. That's
so,
exactly right.
Everybody, I want to, go ahead, Stan.
No, I voted against fracking when I was there 2 years ago. I mean, it was something I didn't believe in then, and I still don't believe in it now.
And we need people like Stan here in the Senate in North Carolina. Stan White, District 1, going back to take his seat where he should be. Remember, 21 votes. 21. One. I mean, I know some cars that hold 21 people. So please, get out and get Stan back in District 1 for your senator. And I want to thank you, Stan, and I want you to come back, Stan, in about,
love to, Michael.
About 3 weeks.
Okay?
Okay,
love to. Okay, Michael, I'm appreciate it a whole lot.
Down. I'm
thank
writing
you,
you down now. Same time.
Okay. All right, I'll put it on my calendar.
Good.
Good luck, Senator. Good luck.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Nan. All right, bye.
You've been listening to Stan White. He is running for the State Senate District 1. And we had, did we just...
okay, we got it, yeah.
We just dropped off Thomas. I don't know where he went.
Okay.
But we have someone holding right here. Who's this? Hello, caller. Hello?
This is Yolanda Michael. How are you?
Yolanda, how are you?
I'm fine, my dear. How are you?
Tell everybody why you're calling in.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. My name is Yolanda Trotman, and I am a candidate for a district court judge here in Mecklenburg County.
And Yolanda, tell everybody what you have been doing the last few years, why you think you should run for district court.
Well, I actually began my career in the classroom. I was a high school teacher here in Mecklenburg County at North Mecklenburg High School for 3 years before I went to law school. Yes, so I actually came to Charlotte in 1992 for undergrad. I went to UNC Charlotte as a teaching fellow. And after I finished teaching at North Mec, I went to law school in Pittsburgh, came back in 2002. Started out at the public defender's office as an assistant public defender for 2 years, doing misdemeanors and serious drug felonies. And then I left and stepped out on faith in 2004 and opened up my own law practice here and have been doing a combination of criminal defense and family law since 2004. But I have decided to run for district court judge. I'm ready to serve the public. We certainly need qualified judges that are connected to and care about the community, and I am committed to a smarter approach to justice.
Well, hey, listen, I wish everybody could explain. You know how many people I have asked who have run for office and who have said,
right,
they had no idea what the office was involved with or how they would tackle the office. It's just that they wanted to run. And you know how many people there are in Charlotte and Mecklenburg County who are in office and have no idea.
Yep.
No idea why they're there. All they know is, well, hey, I got a job because I need some supplemental pay.
Or which district they're serving.
Oh, don't even ask that. But we're going to ask you some questions, and some of them might be something that you can't answer because of when you become the next district court judge. You know, you don't want to say things how you would rule on certain situations. But tell us, before we get to that, what does the district court judge do?
Well, district court is everything from traffic court. It is family court, juvenile court. All of your misdemeanors are in district court. All of your felonies begin in district court unless and until they are indicted, and then they go to superior court. So district court is the court system that affects everyone, everyday people. We all know somebody has a traffic ticket, gone through a divorce, or what have you. So district court literally is the courtroom, or the court system, rather, that affects everyone.
So district court's like a clearinghouse. I said district court is like the clearinghouse, and then you bump it up to the superior. Yeah, okay. I got that.
So they don't have a family court that's separated then.
Now, it depends on now, Mecklenburg County has a separate family court division. Now, smaller counties may not have that, but it's across the board for all district courts, regardless of where you are in the state. Those are the types of matters that are handled. It's just that Mecklenburg County and some of the larger counties may have some specialized courts and judges that are assigned to those particular divisions, whereas other counties, judges may handle all different types of cases, but still on the district court level. The big difference is that it's not a jury trial. Jury trials don't occur on the district court level. They are bench trials.
Okay. So you and the rest of them.
That's it.
Yes.
So here's the thing I'd like to ask you. Are you going to be in the family court side, or do you choose, or they just assign you to what court you're in?
I would be assigned, and that would be at the discretion of our chief in terms of which court I would be assigned to. Typically, it's either criminal or civil or family court or juvenile. Those are the four main areas, and then you float within that area to different types of courtrooms that handle different types of cases.
So you might be criminal court one day, and the next month you might be in family court.
Not likely. At least with Mecklenburg County, if I am in the criminal track, I would likely remain in the criminal track. Same thing with family court. Now with family court, you may do a week in, say, domestic violence court, or you may do a week in civil domestic violence cases. So that there may be some difference and some overlap there, but for the most part, if you're a juvenile judge, occasionally you may come out and do different types of courtrooms, but your primary area is going to be juvenile, family, or criminal, or civil.
Now, what can you say about family court that I can't?
That's a little
boy, are you trying to set me up?
I just want to know, because there are some things that, I'm just glad that you are coming on today, because you have heard, as a matter of fact, listen, I taught for 9.5 years at Northwest School of the Arts, and from 7th to 12th grade, and I taught at John C. Smith 2 years. And we're bringing on right now a gentleman who taught in school for 40 years. Well, almost 40 years. Mr. George Gaffney. Mr. Gaffney?
Yes.
Can
you hear me?
Yes, I hear you fine. See, as I was telling our next district court judge, Yolanda Trotman, that you taught in school for about 40 years. Is that correct?
35,
36. I was close. So, and she was a teacher. So we got about 80 years of teaching here.
That's about right.
So I know what you're talking about, and Mr. Gaffney I know has. But what I wanted to ask you, I'm going to ask George right now. Did you, George, when you were teaching in school, did you ever notice kids that might have a problem, then you later found out that their parents were fighting or their parents were abusing them or something like that?
Yes, you find that a lot. And I always had a girl that I was suspicious of the relationship between her and her father. Sometimes it was something that was shaky there. But, it comes up because normally it comes up because not directly, but you just notice there's something – you know, maybe the kid is just too reluctant to have, when you mention you're going to send for the parent or something like that, you know, they just get, they overreact or something. It's something shaky. So, yeah, there's things when, you know, you pick up this sign. But on the other hand, you got to be careful that you don't run around making accusations either, you
right,
know. But
right.
A lot of times what happens is the classroom teacher really, you pass it on to the guidance department discreetly. You know, it may not be official. You may not write anything official, but you discuss it with the guidance department, let them know that there's something there. And then they, because they have, they're really trained more to ferret out.
Let's see. Judge Trotman. I'm going to call you Judge Trotman. Can you hear me?
I'm by
Hello?
Me.
Okay.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, we had a little delay there. I don't know why, but anyway, when say in that would be, would that be? How would a child that's having a problem at home, say he's being abused, would that come in? That would come into a family court?
No, well, it depends on the situation. If it's a Department of Social Services case, then it would go through juvenile court primarily. And it depends on what the issue is, especially with an abuse issue. Now, if it's already a case where two parents are and there's a custody dispute and there's not a DSS issue, then it may go through family court. But that's really based on a jurisdictional issue in terms of what the underlying issue is for that child. But the example that you give sounds like that would ordinarily originate from perhaps the Department of Social Services case under our juvenile laws, but it could possibly be a family court issue, all of which, of course, is affected by district court, which is why we have to have judges that understand, you know, those important issues and how to address them individually and not have these cookie-cutter, one-size-fits-all approaches to how they handle cases.
What I'm going to ask you is that why, for instance, we've been having in the last month or so, 2 months, major problems with our athletes. Well, we haven't been having major problems with them. The athletes have been causing major problems. Now, I am sure this has been going on since time immemorial. But because of TMZ and because they got cameras in your phone, I got a camera in my watch, too. I got to show you the watch later.
Yeah, please do.
And there are things that are going on. In this, let's just take the specific case of Rice and his fiance
right.
now wife.
Right.
How would something like that come to pass with you? Would that come in as the cops arresting somebody and then having the person out on bail if the cops were called in? How would that – let's take, for instance, the police were called into this specific case where the guy knocked out his wife or his girlfriend in an elevator, dragged her out of the elevator, and just told everybody she was drunk. And then later when she woke up, she wanted to press charges, and she had him arrested. Would he then get out on bail, on recognizance, or would he stay in jail until – he saw a judge. How is that done?
Can't comment on that particular jurisdiction where it happened. District court would come into play depending on how he was charged and what he was charged with. If he was charged with a misdemeanor, for example, then he would come before a district court judge to have his bond set because that can't be set by a magistrate. It has to be set by a judge. So the judge would
right.
then review the case and then set bond at that point. And then if it's a misdemeanor, it would go through the bench trial process in district court. If he's charged with it as a felony, it would still initially begin in district court, and he would come before a person in a similar situation. Of course, I'm not commenting specifically on his case, but if it was
situation
like that, it would be if it's charged as a felony, he would come through initially through video arraignment and would face a district court judge. And if it's a felony case, then it would be set for a bond hearing, and either perhaps no bond would be again, the judge would have to evaluate the circumstances in terms of evaluating bond. And then eventually it would still remain in district court unless and until that person is indicted. So the felony case would still initially remain in district court unless and until there's an indictment, and that's when it goes up to superior court. And the superior court judge may or may not address bail or bond, rather, or whatever the circumstances are up there. So.
Okay, and not talking, I'm going to play this TMZ piece, but I don't want you to talk exactly about this. I want you to give us the ins and out how the court system would work. You understand? So don't tell us how you think it should work. And, George, I want you to listen, too.
Today we reported that a law school official sent a copy of the video from the elevator showing Ray Rice punching his fiance at the time, now his wife, and sent that to an NFL league executive. We also learned that there is confirmation from an unidentified woman at the league office calling Rice and leaving a voicemail, which I heard, a 12-second voicemail, saying that she received it and that it's telling. I also saw an enhanced copy of some audio. In the enhanced copy, you can see a little bit more clear. It's less grainy, and you can hear some of the background conversation that's going on as this happens. The NFL is adamant that no one in their league office who was of knowledge saw the video. We know that one person, at the very least, had access saw that video. What happens is going to be an investigation internally by the NFL, and it'll be up to them to determine their course of action. The angle that I saw, the more angle that's enhanced, you can see that there's some spitting, and you can also hear, which I think is the most important part of this, that you can hear in the background someone revel saying no comment and saying she's drunk. We do not hear Ray Rice respond. I do not hear Ray Rice responding at all. In fact, I see him pulling out a phone, and that's all. We're hearing a lot of people out there calling for Roger Goodell to step down. But again, at this point, all we know is that someone in the league office had access to and saw that video. We do not know that Roger Goodell eyeballed that video himself.
Now, you have something you want to say?
No, I'll wait to the judge.
Okay, now you see, this is what I want to know. Okay,
now, before you go further, Michael, I could barely hear a lot of that clip. It was really difficult for me to hear.
Yeah, it was a difficult clip when I got it. But what he was saying is that the league office, the NFL, says that they knew nothing about this tape. Okay, what he says, exactly what happened on the tape was that he showed this Rice hitting the girlfriend, knocking her out, dragging her out, and then he told people no cops, okay? But eventually the police came, and he was charged with a third-degree felony. So here's the problem I have.
They both were charged.
They were both charged.
They were both charged, yes.
They were both charged because didn't know who was who, but evidently Janice, she lost the fight in the third-degree felony, but she was knocked out. Now, the thing is, where do the police stand in this particular case? If this happened to Joe Blow in the Ritz-Carlton downtown.
Well, let me take that question.
Right, go ahead.
Since I'm retired.
So he's a retired policeman here in Bernardville. Go ahead, tell us.
What would happen would be the police would respond, and they would arrest who they deem as the perpetrator. Or, in this case, they were, of course, complainants. They would charge him and kick it to the DA, and the DA or the ADA would make the case, whether it goes forward or they would be kicked loose. Or they would go in front of a judge.
Okay, now, evidently this happened because he was charged with a third-degree felony.
Right.
Now, if you were the judge in this particular case, Joe Blow and his girlfriend, third-degree felony, would these people would have lawyers, so both of them would have to go in front of the judge, is correct?
Yes, correct.
Or the one charged, he was only charged with a third-degree felony, I understand.
It's as simple as so here, according to ESPN.
But I have in here there was a third-degree felony.
Okay.
So what I'm asking in a case like this, when it it's if you would, is this something that would come to you?
It would come to me, but I can't comment on how I would handle a bond hearing or how I would handle the case. I can't make any comment directly, even in a hypothetical in that situation. I can't comment.
Yeah, I understand that. I just want to know what the procedures are. Okay.
Procedurally, if a person is charged with a third degree, well, I don't know, because our felony system, the way that we classify cases, regardless if it's a felony, it's as I indicated before, a felony case would come before a judge initially for video arraignment, and then it would come back before a district court judge to address the issue of bond. And, of course, a video arraignment would be a determination of whether or not counsel needed to be appointed, or if there's an attorney, that attorney would typically be present and say, hey, I represent whomever this person is. And then it would be reset for a bond hearing within 10 days and then reset for a probable cause hearing within 10 days after that. And then if in the interim, it could be indicted at some point, which would remove jurisdiction from district court and then send it up to superior court. So that would be the general procedure, but it would come before a district court at least twice in that process, typically before an indictment comes down, if that in fact happens.
Now, in this particular case, it was dropped. And he was, I think he had to do a couple of weeks on of intensive, I don't want to slap my wife training anymore, or girlfriend training anymore. So how would that come about? Why would it be dropped? Can't the police say, no, I'm not dropping this. I want this man to go in front of a trial and a judge charge him.
No, it's not up to the police. It's up to the DA.
I mean, the DA. I mean, the DA, should say.
Yeah,
well, can't the DA say, no, I don't want to drop this case?
Yes, the DA can.
And so it wouldn't be up to you. If the DA drops the case, that's a case, one less case off your docket. Is that correct?
Are you talking to me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. No, well, judges don't have the power to dismiss it at that point. That's completely up to a district attorney. I mean, whatever cases come before a judge on the docket, those are the cases that judge would address for that day.
Now, you see, the problem I have is with this is, and a problem that I see with a lot of movie stars and a lot of celebrities and people with money is cases like this are dropped all the time, and you never hear about it again. But Joe Blow and Mary in the elevator in Vegas who got drunk and punched out, they're going to go and get a record. They're going to go fingerprint, book, bam, slam, bam, thank you, ma'am, in the jail, and then released on $50,000 bond, and you better come back. Now, the system here is unfair, I believe. Because I believe that anybody that does this, you know, there are circumstances in all cases. There are circumstances in all cases that have to be addressed, but and it's up to the DA to pursue this. Now, if this was Joe Blow, we wouldn't have heard about this. And we heard about it now because he's Ray Rice. The problem that I have is now they want to prosecute him after the fact.
Yeah, and also, according to the New Jersey penal law, a simple assault is considered a disorderly person offense, which has a maximum penalty of 6 months in jail and or $1,000 fine. So where did we get this?
It's in the paperwork that I downloaded that it was a third-degree felony.
Well, maybe they raised the charge, but it's a simple
But he still got out, though. You see, it was dismissed. The DA didn't go any further. So the thing is that when it's presented in front of you, Joe Blow and Mary, what do you look for in a person that's in front of you, since there's no jury here, that you're going to decide the fate of this person?
Well, I guess it depends on which circumstance. Are you talking about in a criminal case? Are you talking about a family? I mean, are you talking about specifically a criminal case?
Is this a criminal case where Joe Blow knocks out a girl in the elevator? or knocks the girl out in the stairwell.
Domestic violence.
This is domestic violence, is it?
Domestic violence.
But is it domestic violence if they're only engaged?
No, it's still, it's person. Yeah, it's domestic violence.
Oh, domestic violence. Okay. Domestic violence. So in domestic violence, do you look for what do you look for in a case like that when two people or one person is in front of you?
And again, I can't comment on in terms of how I would make a decision with bond. I can tell you what the law says and what a judge can consider, but I can't specifically what I would do in that case. For example, a judge has to consider if the person's a flight risk, what are their ties to the community, what their prior record level is, have they had any prior convictions for the same type of offense.
Right.
Those types of things are what you can consider when posting a bond or addressing bond. Now, as far as a conviction is concerned, if a person is convicted, for example, it's going to depend on whether or not the person has a prior history. It's going to depend on any number of things. If a person has a trial, that may have a different determination on how a judge would consider a case at the point of judgment. It may be an issue that there may be some intervention that the court can do in terms of setting probation. I mean, the wonderful thing about district court is that there's a lot of creativity in terms of what a judge can do to either address the root of the issues that brought that person to court in the first place, or, you know, are diversionary measures that can either address those issues to keep it from happening again, because obviously the goal is not to see somebody come in on the same cycle doing the same type of thing, if there's a creative way that you can address it. So that's the best way that I can answer, because every case is going to be different. Every defendant is going to be different. Every client that comes before is going to be different, you know, based on their circumstances. But those are the basic things that you would have to consider, you know, per the statutes when you're evaluating a case.
So when are you running for the state Supreme Court? I mean, because
well,
I think that's such a, that is such a fantastic
for me.
Yes,
that's a fantastic answer. And you made it so simple. It's simple. Your answer is very simple. It's to the point and simple what you look for. And the thing that we want in a judge is temperament.
Yes.
I think temperament is 80% of what a judge needs. And there's a lot of judges who don't have the temperament.
Right.
And that should never be a judge. And in a case like this, I mean, there are all sorts of circumstances that got these two people in front of you or this person in front of you. It could be he just got fired from his job. It could be he just got drunk outside because his mother died. It could be a thousand or her, the same thing. There are a lot of things that bring two people are always different. They're not the same. And when you have two people that are different, you have clashes and how maybe one or both need to be in therapy. Okay? But to me, in the case we're pointing out right here, and I was told I was wrong by 1,001 people already, that there's no way in the world I would have married this guy after he knocked me out like Mike Tyson. Now, hey, maybe she's looking at the ring and the $40 million contract he's got and say, hey, I'll take half of that when I am 2 years in, and I'll go take some lumps. But now she's got nothing, zip, nothing, zero, because he ain't there no more. So now the judge, when they come in front of you as a judge, is part of, you said it already, part of it is a look at see what he has done in the past or she has done in the past and whether or not they will commit and do the same thing again. Am I correct?
That's correct.
You're correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So, and you don't have a crystal ball in front of you. So you're weighing a lot of things that's in front of you, whether or not, hey, maybe do, and you're not a marriage counselor. Although you might play one in the courtroom sometimes, but you're not a marriage counselor, but don't you also have to, don't you think in your mind, hey, you know, these people, they shouldn't be together.
But you can't say that, though.
But you can't say that.
Can't say that.
And to me, because you're only known You only know the you don't know these people, and you only know what the DA gave you, and you only know what the defense lawyer gave you. So,
right.
And they're both biased. So you have to weigh the biases and then cut through it and make the decision on your own. So this is why we need judicial temperament. And for you to give us and everybody else the explanation you did, I think is fabulous. I don't think it can be said any plainer. Mr. Gaffney.
Yes.
Well, what do you think about the judicial temperament of Judge Trotter in her explanation? You taught history.
Well, my thing is that I feel very confident in her because she constantly referred to the fact that this was an area that she should not go into. In other words, she's not shooting from the hip. She was methodical in what she laid out. She didn't exceed that. She didn't minimize it. I thought, she showed good judgment, and that's a judge should have good judgment.
Yeah. Make her a good judge.
Shown that Judge Trotter will be running for the Supreme Court of the state of North Carolina very shortly. what do you consider? And I think you went through this, but I'd like you to just come back to the full circle and tell us why, what you will give us as a judge in district court.
Well, I think it's three things. When I decided to run, I literally sat in all of the courtrooms of the judges that were up for election, and I didn't make this decision lightly. I have a wonderful law practice. I love what I do, but I was troubled by what I was seeing in some courtrooms. I was troubled by how people were being treated. I was troubled by how I saw members of the bar in terms of how they were being treated. So the first thing that I am committed to is, quite frankly, changing the atmosphere in the courtroom. Changing the atmosphere of what it feels like when a person walks into a courtroom and when attorneys and litigants walk into a courtroom where, at the end of the day, let's face it, people just want to feel like they've been heard. They don't want to be disrespected in the process. They don't want to be embarrassed in front of a courtroom full of people. And that changes when you change the atmosphere in terms of treating people with dignity and respect. The thing that I'm most proud of is the fact that I have represented the homeless. I've represented the disabled, veterans, people with mental health issues. I've represented doctors. I've represented PhDs. I've represented all different types of people. And at the end of the day, when people come into the courthouse, they're not coming to the courthouse in the most ideal of circumstances. So understanding the problems that everyday people face is critical before you come on the bench, but also while you're on the bench. The third thing I would say is for me, absolutely has been the case during the course of my campaign, and it's really highlighted for me personally more than never how important it is for judges to be connected and to remain connected to the community and not just the communities where they are most comfortable, because you have to be able to be out within the community to be able to understand the problems that everyday people are facing, because if you cannot step into the shoes of the person that is before you in the criminal case, or understand what the family dynamic may be in a juvenile case, or in family court, the decisions you make can completely change the lives of families. So you have to have had that experience, but you also have to continue to educate yourself and be willing to be a part of the community that you serve, because true judges that are effective understand the importance it is to serve the public and put the community first. It is important to be firm, but it's also important to be fair. And if you can balance those two things and do that within the confines of protecting the community but also understanding the community, then I think that's what will make judges effective. That's what I've been committed to. And I think that beyond all of that is what I do know that I won't do is legislate from the bench. I do know and recognize that judges can be emotional, but if it needs to be a time that you have to just stop and take a recess or take an issue under advisement, it's okay to do that, because some judges do rush to judgment or made up their minds or they get caught up in the emotion of it and they aren't able to step back away from that and then be able to make a decision that's reasoned and a decision that is fair. for everyone in the room. So certainly changing the atmosphere, certainly having a smarter approach to justice and understanding how the decisions you make just don't affect the person, but also how they can impact the community and in some cases even the taxpayers. But then, of course, the other thing is being connected and remaining connected to the community and not letting your day end at 5 o'clock when you take off the robe. If you're taking off your robe at 5 o'clock and you always go home and we don't see you out in the community and you don't express any interest in the communities that you serve, then you're not being effective. And that's why I'm running, and those are the types of things that I will bring to the bench.
So you don't want to be a Judge Judy?
I don't want to be a TV judge.
I'm talking about when you come in, you tell the other party, shut up, I'm not talking to you. I mean, that's for TV. But a lot of people think that's how a courtroom is conducted.
And she was never like that in court, never.
And, you know, that's TV.
Yes.
People don't understand what it is when you go into a court. And now, you, when you're in a courtroom, you have people that can come in, because anybody can come in the courtroom and sit down. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. But your main focus is to give the person in front of you is not there because they went shopping at Pathmark or Harris Teeter.
Yes.
But that's a New York term. Anyway, the thing is, they went...
Yeah,
Pathmark was a big store in the New
and
York.
It still is.
And still is, right. Anyway, that's my New York coming out. Anyway.
Yeah, Southern. I have no idea what you're talking about.
they're in front of you because they went shoplifting at Harris Teeter.
Right.
Not shopping at Harris Teeter. So, but why? Would you ask them why you did it?
I can't comment on that.
Is that something that you can comment on?
I mean, technically, a judge could ask that, but whether or not that's appropriate, it would depend on the circumstances. For example, if a person is pro se and it means they represent themselves, that may be appropriate. But you certainly wouldn't ask that of someone who's represented by counsel, because obviously their responses can be used against them. But the attorney for that person and say, you know, client X did this because of why. But as far as a pro se person who's representing themselves, you have to ask the basic information, because you've got to get a feel for who that person is and what brought that person to make whatever that decision is before you can pass judgment.
Because I understand that, and I'm the type of person that always wants to know why. I got to know why, and I want to have a feel. You know, why did you go shoplifting at Harris Teeter? I would want to know that, and that is something that would bug me as a judge, not knowing why a person does the things they do. And that seems to be a little thing that you might not ever get a feel of unless that person was representing himself. And,
that may be the case.
Excuse me?
But if I can add on to that, but I do think that's where becoming involved in the community and understanding the dynamics of the different communities comes into play. So, I mean, if that's something that you care about and you're involved and you're active within the communities, then you may not need that. You may not get the answer to the question why, but you may understand and understand the dynamics of that particular community better so that you can better serve that community. And that's why what I said earlier in terms of how important it is to make sure that you're connected, not just where it's comfortable, but all communities in the area where you serve.
Well, what areas does District 1 involve?
Well, that's the wonderful thing. My race is countywide. So it doesn't matter where you live in Mecklenburg County. You cast your vote. You go to the bottom of the ballot. The district court races are towards the bottom of the ballots, and the judicial races in general are at the bottom of the ballot. So your listeners definitely need to know how critically important it is that you keep voting, you keep going until you get down to the bottom of the ballot, because there's a natural drop-off for some voters as they reach the national election, so we have to make sure that people know that you keep going and you go down to the bottom of the ballot and make sure that you cast your vote. But my race is nonpartisan. All the judicial races are nonpartisan, so you'll appear on all ballots, and it's countywide, so it doesn't matter where you live within the county. You can cast your vote for me.
Just make
sure, absolutely will.
If the FOP reaches out to you, make sure you get back to them, okay, Ms. Trotman?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Okay, if the FOP, if the Fraternal Order of Police reaches out to you, make sure you get back to them so you can
absolutely
go in front of them. Okay, all right.
The thing that I have, and I've been talking about this with the Randy Bolo, the chair of the Democratic Party, because I am a Democrat, and I have been asking him, how can we change the ballot? Because judges, especially the district court judges, are more important than the President of the United States because they affect you every single day. They affect somebody or some thousand people every single day of your life. And if so, they need to be at the top of the ballot, and the President of the United States needs to be on the bottom of the ballot. Because those people at the bottom of the ballot always get the share. Because somebody wants to come in and vote for the president or vote for the governor, vote for the mayor, later for everybody else. Not knowing that that policeman on the corner is going to have them in front of that judge who's on that ballot next week when they do something wrong. So judges are more important to our everyday lives than people know. And I want everybody out there to vote from the bottom up. Go to the last page and vote backwards. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do that. Yeah, but some people think it's a rocket scientist to vote. You have to be a rocket scientist to vote. And it's not true. And I want everybody out there to vote for Yolanda Trotman.
I second that.
Thank you.
Because she is the clear choice who knows what a judge should do. And believe me, we've had drunks as judges. We have wife beaters as judges.
Scoundrels?
Scoundrels as judges. Judges take sentences, just like these judges over there in Pennsylvania, who they found out after 15 years were taking money to lock teenagers up in the jail system because the jail system was privately owned and they were getting paid under the table.
Right.
So, hey, we don't want that here. We want judges to know what the hell they're doing.
Indeed.
And Yolanda Trotman does, ladies and gentlemen.
Indeed.
And Yolanda, how can people get a hold of you to help put you in the black robes?
Well, they can visit my website, which is Yolanda Trotman for Judge, and that's T-R-O-T-M-A-N, for Judge, F-O-R-Judge.com. They can call at 980-224-3582. Again, that's 980-224-3582. They can follow me on Instagram or Twitter at Yolanda for Judge. Of course, my Facebook page is Yolanda Trotman for Judge. And that has daily campaign updates in terms of where I am in the community, upcoming events, ways. That's an easy way to add yourself to my mailing list. Certainly come out to any of the campaign events that we have coming up, which are on the Facebook page and are also on the website. They can donate through the website, and then they can also volunteer because, you know, we have an amazing group of volunteers, but you can never have enough volunteers and enough boots on the ground, so that we will definitely need more volunteers, and they can sign up to volunteer through the website and, of course, donate as well through the website. And, again, that's YolandaTrotmanForJudge.com.
That's right. And you tell Annetta I said hello.
I will. She's probably listening.
Okay. And don't forget about the FOP. When they reach out to you, make sure you reach back to them, okay?
Absolutely.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you don't want to stand in front of a drunk or a wife beater or a scoundrel, put Yolanda Trotman in the black robes instead of that person. And we know who they are.
Indeed we do.
We know who they are, and there's plenty of them. So, hey, and you know, it's always about, it's always better to have a woman judge. Especially if she's good looking.
You can, hey, Michael, can I also add one quick thing? Early voting begins on October 23rd. I'm not, and of course, Election Day is on November 4th. I want people to vote during early voting. Vote on October 23rd. You have between October 23rd and November 1st for early voting. And, of course, Election Day is November 4th. But let's take this home during the early voting time.
And I am also pushing absentee ballot. So, people,
absolutely,
if you get an absentee ballot, put the first person, the very first person you vote for, turn all the pages over and check Yolanda Trotman first before you vote for anybody else. All right? And I want to thank you, Yolanda. George, I want you to stay on. And, Yolanda, I want you back with us.
I certainly will.
In 3 weeks. Okay, I want you to tell us how it's coming. Well, but before you go, where's your next, do you know the next engagement that you have for the public?
Yes, we have a campaign event fundraiser on September the 17th. That's next Wednesday. That will be at Sports One Charlotte. That's at 521 College Street. We have another event on September the 30th. That will be at Roosters in South Park, near South Park Mall. But there's also a very important judicial forum that is on this Monday at St. Luke Baptist Church on the address is 1600 North Avenue. All of the judicial candidates will be there. So I highly encourage listeners in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area to come out to that event. It begins at 6 o'clock. Again, that's at St. Luke Missionary Baptist Church, and that will be a judicial forum that will feature all of the candidates where you can have some of your questions answered and really see the candidates side by side so you can make an informed choice.
That's probably tell Annette to send me that information because I will go there because I'm going to interview some of these scoundrels. All right?
Well, all right. All right. Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been my absolute pleasure.
That's been ours very much. Thank you very much.
All right,
and,
thank you. Have a good rest of the day.
You too.
That was Yolanda Trotman, who will be our next district court judge. Notice we didn't mention who she's running against because I don't care.
It doesn't matter.
Don't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Now, getting back to more important things, Ray Rice punching his fiance and girlfriend.
Well, you know, with everything being said, I think what he did to her was horrific. I don't think you should never, ever, ever hit anyone, especially a woman. But he was already punished. How are they going to come back and repunish this guy because they're claiming they didn't see the tape? Doesn't
they
make any sense.
They didn't see the tape. They didn't see the tape. Now, I want to go over a timeline.
Okay.
And, George, I want you to listen to this. We're going to do a timeline here, okay? All right. Let's see if I can get this up. This timeline. This is the timeline that has been put together by, I think it was, it's by ESPN.
TMZ.
No, it was, yes, TMZ, you're correct. Just listen to this.
The timeline. TMZ Sports releases the video from inside the elevator early Monday morning, 4 a.m. Eastern Time. That video showed Ray Rice punching his then fiance, now wife, Janae. Ravens terminated Rice's contract shortly thereafter. The NFL suspended Rice indefinitely right after the Ravens released him. That was Monday. Tuesday, as this story continued, the NFL, TMZ reported early in the morning, really late overnight, that the NFL did not ask the casino for the video. Commissioner Goodell told CBS that they did ask law enforcement for the tape, but were told no. Ray and Janae both made statements publicly. Ray via text message, Janae via Instagram. Wednesday, the AP reported yesterday evening that the NFL received tapes in April. Commissioner Goodell called for then that independent investigation last night, that being Wednesday night today. Thursday, as we are on game day on NFL Network, getting ready for the Ravens and the Steelers this evening.
Now, So everybody is focused on what the timeline is now. It's been going on. What do you say, Bernard?
No, I don't understand. You know, they were both arrested for a simple assault. Of course, he gave for that roundhouse punch. Her slapping him. But again, they're both arrested. And he was already punished. So why are they coming back with this double jeopardy and hit them again? Because of the outcry? The tape has been gone since, what, August?
Mm-hmm.
Come on now. I think double jeopardy applies here.
This tape's been around so long, I think even Blake saw it.
Yes, he did. Blake's 26.
That's right. So, George, what do you think about that timeline?
Well, again, what's phony? It's not a judicial thing when they fine him and stuff on the job. So I think they can go back and it's not like he was before a judge. He was the governing body of his job. I can see where they could change the punishment one way or the other. But here's my thing: if anybody, you're taping right now, you're taping in your studio. One of the guys at the studio punches the other guy. And I'm investigating or something like the NFL. And I said, I asked the police for the tape of what took place on the air on the Lawson show.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't give it to me. Right, of course. The police aren't a film distribution center. That was a ridiculous thing when I heard it the first time before all this blew up. I said, it's ridiculous for the NFL to say the police wouldn't give it to us. Damn right, the police aren't involved in distributing film. The hotel that taped that thing can sell it out on the street. They can sell it out on the street at a 50 cents a pop. So it's ridiculous for you to say, oh, I asked we asked the police and they wouldn't give it to us. Of course, if I want the FBI wouldn't give me a tape of the Kennedy assassination. It's not the FBI's job. They're not a film distribution center. So that was when I heard that, I said, this is something phony. Because the hotel owns the tape. The police got a copy of it or whatever. But it's owned by the hotel. They could sell that out on the street. So it's ridiculous to say we couldn't get it because the police wouldn't give it to us. Of course the police wouldn't give it to you.
And they could have asked.
That's not a question.
They could have asked Ray Rice's lawyer for it.
Exactly right.
Could have asked anybody, but then, the hotel would have been glad. The hotel, I think, would be glad to give anything they could to help the NFL so the NFL books things into that hotel. So, I mean, it's ridiculous when he said that we asked the police. Of course the police. Gee, I asked J. Edgar Hoover if he would come over to my house for dinner and bring a tape with him. He refused. Yes, I think he would refuse.
Well, yeah.
That was ridiculous.
If Hoover was batting his eyes at you, maybe he would come over. But listen, I have now going to play a tape, Mr. George Gaffney's favorite sports analyst of all time.
Well, who would that be?
Stephen A. Smith.
Ah, he got in trouble last month.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he got in trouble.
So I know, George, this is your favorite sports analyst, so I just want to play this. I'm playing it just for you. Now, listen.
Well,
let me just say, before you
play this, I'm telling you, how Skip Bayless and Stephen A. can sit around and they both approach like what they're saying, like that's the gossip. I mean, that is the most, it's like inbreeding. It's like inbreeding. Each of them treats the other like he's really, oh, this is the final word. This is some kind of brilliant statement. And they both continue, they have no more idea what's going on 90% of the time than anybody else. It's unbelievable how they present this front like, oh, I got to listen to every word he says.
Yeah.
They don't say anything that's earth-shaking, but go ahead.
It's because Stephen A. Smith says it emphatically.
Yes.
That's what makes it so. You think?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Let's listen to this.
Okay. And I understand that on a day like today, it's real easy to pile on. It's real easy to jump on a bandwagon. You have a lot of women out there who are right to feel the way that they feel when they say he should never play again. We understand that because women who are victims of domestic violence have a heightened level of sensitivity that somebody like myself who's never been involved in domestic violence other than me putting my hands on men who have domestically abused a woman. I mean, I can't harbor the same level of sensitivity that they do. But as pundits, as commentators, as journalists, as people, you know, in a position that we're in to disseminate messages over the airwaves, how is proud as I am of Michael Vick, how am I going to look at a guy that spent 18 months in a federal penitentiary for the whole dogfighting scandal think he should be in the league? Dante Stallworth, you know, was driving under the influence and ultimately killed somebody in the morning, but, you know, the person was walking towards the highway, I believe it was, in Miami.
Yep.
But that person died. Leonard Little, the same thing, behind a vehicle,
yep,
ultimately killed somebody. But they were back into the league. There are people that have been responsible, albeit not intentionally, there are people who have been responsible for the deaths of other human beings that have been allowed back in the NFL.
Yep.
How am I going to sit there and say that Ray Rice doesn't deserve to be a Ray Rice? Now, you got a lot of people out there that are speculating, well, you know, he must have done this before, or he'll do it again. All we know about is this one incident. Before then, what we were told and what the facts showed was that Ray Rice had been a model citizen. Now, that's not to defend him because, again, what we saw on video is egregious. It cannot be defended. I mean, he deserves to be out for the year as far as I'm concerned. He should be ashamed to show his face, to be quite honest with you. But the point is that at some point in time, this dude is 27 years old. What are we supposed to do? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I keep telling you, Skip, and I mean this not just in terms of, speaking monetarily, but I'm a capitalist, man. And I think along the lines of, if you're not out there earning an honest living, your problems become our problems as a society, because we ain't going to just leave you on the street and not try to take care of you. And so as a result of that, if you are in a position where you have an opportunity to resurrect yourself, to really rehabilitate yourself, then that's the way it should be. If we're going to feel that way about Ray Rice, then think about what you're saying about people who end up in jail for whatever reason. If the justice system is going to let you out and allow you to revisit society, if we're finished with them too, then why are we letting them out? Because they're going to be our problems. Because, again, how are they going to earn a living? I think these are things that we need to be sensitive to. And I think in the case of Ray Rice, he made an incredible mistake. He is going to pay for it. He's paying for it right now.
Yep.
He deserves to pay for it. But to look at him as a finished product, like somebody who never, ever, ever deserves to play in the NFL again, what I would ask people is to do your homework and look at some of the dudes that have been allowed back in the
yep.
league, and then come back and talk to me.
That's fair. I'm with you. I do not believe that Ray Rice should be banned for life. However, I think he might have effectively been banned for life.
27 years.
Yeah. So let's look at this. He definitely should be gone for this year. And then I'm glad you brought up Michael Vick, because if you didn't, I was going to.
Mm-hmm.
Then obviously we would need, and the league would need, for Ray Rice to demonstrate that he has undergone successful counseling, which I don't believe he has to this point, even though he said, and remember, I made a stand. I'm not sure you're here for the show, but I made a stand the day after that open session, the first open media session
yeah.
they did with the teammates ringing around the media.
Yeah, I remember.
Now, I made a strong case. I'm not buying what he's saying. A lot of people bought it. Oh, he's contrite. He's sincere. I didn't buy it because I didn't like what he was saying about what he was going to do about it. What about your counseling? What about, will you become an advocate, a speaker against domestic violence? Will you tour the league and talk to other players about it? I wanted to hear all those things from Ray, and I heard none of that from him. And, of course, he wouldn't talk about what happened inside the elevator in that session, which I thought was significant. So, to me, until I hear some of that and see some of that, and he demonstrates it to the league, he can't even be considered for reinstatement. But here's the football issue and the reality of this. By the time he is allowed to play, he'll be 28 years of age,
right,
at a position that historically has had the shortest lifespan in the league, running back.
Now,
right?
The average 3 yards a carry. Wasn't that impressive last year?
Well, he went from 2011, when he had a combined yards of 2,068 running and receiving, to last year, they fell to 981. He got banged up in the preseason, the preseason game at Dallas. Are you sure, Stephen A. Smith, that anybody would take a chance on Ray Rice? Has he become more trouble than he is worth going forward? Because,
well, listen.
You just say, hey, is he really that good? We're not talking about Adrian Peterson.
To answer the question here, I was down on Ray Rice because of his game.
Okay.
I thought, you know, there was games last year where he averaged 2 yards a carry. He was pathetic.
Okay.
I'm like, take all of this out of the equation. As a football player, he didn't seem as if he would be missed. Okay? So when you add this to the mix, the question is he worth the trouble? Clearly to the Baltimore Ravens, he wasn't. But at the same time, again, when you talk about whether or not he should be allowed back into the league, let's watch and monitor things from the perspective. I'm not talking about being all in their business, because I think Jhené Palmer-Rice has a point where, you know, they're married. It's their personal business. Now, it happened in a public setting,
yep,
which is on video, which means that she needs to be careful about the level of sensitivity,
yep,
that she's showing in terms of, you know, spewing her vitriol at the media and the public at large for judging. Well, it's just that it happened in a public place. That's how we all know about it. Okay, so with a husband. So we understand it from that perspective.
Yep.
But at the same time, I think we need to be careful about wanting to close the book, wanting to close the door on a 27-year-old, not just because he's 27, not just because this was a heinous mistake and he's going to pay for it, but what she's saying is that he ain't the only one paying for it.
Yep.
It's all of them. She's paying for it. Their family is paying for it. And so when we look at it from that perspective,
yep,
I'm saying that can't matter now as it pertains to the punishment that Ray Rice has to deal with. But as it pertains to the future, in terms of closing the book, there's a whole bunch of people. Now, certainly not mistakes this heinous.
Yeah.
Some worse than this,
sure,
most considerably less than this. But 27-year-olds make mistakes a lot.
Yeah.
And as far as I'm concerned, you know, I would hope that he would rehabilitate himself, deal with it, and then have an opportunity to resurrect his life. Let's be careful about closing a book on a 27-year-old.
All right, we'll discuss this more further. Let's go to what we were talking about earlier, Stephen A. You alluded to it. Jhené Rice posting this.
Okay, so I guess 27-year-olds, he did say 27-year-olds, 27-year-olds need rehabilitation. How about that 19-year-old who escaped? They just caught him now. He killed 3 people. He needs rehabilitation too. Not that I'm equating Ray Rice to a killer, but as you said, George, who the hell do these people think they are, Skip Bayless and him?
Well, they talk to each other. They have to build each other up because that's the show.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? If they have to build each other up. I had no problem with what they were saying today as far as it was reasonable and stuff. I didn't think they were totally insane stuff they sometimes say. But, you know, the other thing is that this girl, I mean, if you knock me out on national television, out, and then I got my clothes hiked up above my waistline, and I turn around and the next day marry you, there's something wrong with this picture. I mean, she married him, or she married that $40 million contract that she thought he had. You could knock me out, believe me. You could knock me out if you got $40 million to split with me. I could go for that.
Hey, $40 million. You'd marry Ray Rice.
I would, and be proud, and
you
be proud of it.
That's right. I walk around, say, "Yeah, flashing my diamond ring and my gold tooth in my mouth." Hell yes. So here's the thing: we have the Ray Rice has now become the good guy in this whole situation, because the NFL. You cannot tell me that the NFL did not know every single in and out of this whole thing. Now, I'm going to play one other thing here. There is no way that, as I would say before, the NFL didn't know anything about this, because the NFL, as it was said before, and I'm trying to figure out where it was said, they have Secret Service that puts the Secret Service to shame. I said, first of all, the NFL has the former FBI director as their security chief.
Mueller.
I mean, and he's a judge also. So you can't tell me that they spoke to Mueller and said, what do you think we should be doing? I'm sure he would have told him, he would have told them, no, I don't think this is a good idea. But now we're getting back to the point Mueller works for them.
Yes, he does.
What do you think about that, George?
Well, that whole thing is, I mean, there's something, they were covering up something with that because, I mean, again, it's just not hard to get those tapes. I mean, if a TV show's got a tape, how can the NFL not get it? You know, a TV show is not, the NFL, and then when Nike and Adidas and all those companies started pulling this guy's jersey and stuff,
right.
That was a big blow. You know, I mean, that's serious money.
Uh-huh.
That's serious money. So for them to claim that they didn't have all the information, you can't. You if you don't have all the information, that's just it's like the Governor Christie thing. All the people who work for you claim they don't. He didn't know what the people who worked for him were doing. He picked them to work for him. They weren't happen to be walking by, and you know they didn't volunteer for something. He got these people. He recruited them. They owe their allegiance to him. They work for him. And yet he's saying they were out there being cowboys by themselves. I don't understand how you can even claim that. That's a fireable offense to not know. To say that you had no control over the people who worked for you is just as bad as not knowing what they did or not knowing what was going on. You know.
Right. Well, we talked about this yesterday, last night. That if Chris Christie didn't know they were blocking that dig on highway.
He knew.
He needs to be gone. I mean, because he's evidently, this is a man who's a micromanager.
Manager, yes.
As a state attorney. Oh, no, he was a U.S. attorney. That's
yes,
right,
yes,
he was a U.S. attorney.
Well,
so,
and here's
you
the thing.
Here's the thing
about that, too. You're blocking the highway. They act like, oh, well, you know, that's going to make a few people late for work. That's ambulances trying to take a patient in. That's doctors or nurses trying to get to the hospital for surgery. You know what I mean? It's somebody may have to get home and take medication. They act like, you know, the way they approached it originally was like, oh, well, it was just a prank. It's not a prank when you put people's lives in jeopardy. And
it's
that's what, you know, seemed to be lost in the shuffle.
And it's affected two different states. And it affected one little county in one state. Two different states it affected.
New York and New Jersey.
So now it gets to, how come Cuomo didn't know?
Because his court authority chief didn't tell him.
I don't believe that. Because so his chief says he corrected it when it was done. So you're telling me he's not going to tell us, well, hey, there's a situation down here, boss. Guess what Fat Boy is doing over there in Jersey? He's killing us down here. You better be aware of this. And Cuomo said, yeah, okay, we're aware of it. I ain't going to say nothing. I'm going to use this as a weapon to blunt him over the head with. But now it's backfiring on him because he didn't smoke out Christie. It's backfiring on him. Now, here's another... soundbite on this, and this is from who I like Keith Oatman.
I like Keith Oatman.
I mean, he can go off defense sometimes, but I like Keith, and that's just what Keith Oatman said about it.
We begin tonight with the unavoidable and simple truth that intentionally or by neglect, the Atlantic County, New Jersey District Attorney's Office, the Baltimore Ravens, the National Football League, and Commissioner Roger Goodell have conducted a cover-up of Ray Rice's brutal assault on his then-fiancée on February 15th. There is no other conclusion possible. Each body, each leading individual involved came to a judicial conclusion about what had happened to Janae Palmer and what should happen to Ray Rice. And each, through deception or incompetence, misled the public, damaged the efforts of every man and every woman in this country seeking to merely slow down the murderous epidemic of domestic violence, and made a mockery of the process by which those who batter those they claim to love are to be brought to justice. And not one of them, not Commissioner Goodell, not NFL Senior Vice President Adolfo Birch, not NFL Chief Counsel Jeff Pasch, not Baltimore Team President Richard Cass, not Baltimore General Manager Ozzie Newsom, not Assistant Prosecutor Diane Ruberton of Atlantic County, New Jersey, not Prosecutor Jim McClain, not Superior Court Judge Michael Doino, not Ray Rice himself. No matter what actions were taken today against Rice, nor what might be taken in the future, none of them have any remaining credibility, and each must leave or be expelled from their current positions. and despite the obsession of the moment, it does not truly matter whether they had seen this video before today. The league, the team, the prosecutors either whitewashed Ray Rice's brutal assault without ever having seen this video, or they saw the video and whitewashed Rice's brutal assault anyway. I accuse prosecutors McLean and Drew Burton and Judge Donio, even with the full weight of the law behind them, of failing to seek or failing to obtain or failing to act upon that in-elevator video, of failing to put Ray Rice in jail where he belongs. The state of New Jersey must immediately begin an inquiry into whether or not the failures of McLean and Drew Burton and Donio are mere incompetence or if they rose to the level of criminal malfeasance. I accuse President Cass and General Manager Newsom of Baltimore of failing to act internally after the ludicrousness of the Rice 2-game suspension should have become apparent even to them. They have had 6 weeks to add a team suspension to Rice's token league punishment to try to make the scales of justice slightly less out of all balance. They did nothing until they terminated Rice's contract today after all of them failed to get away with it. Mr. Cass and Mr. Newsom put the meaninglessness of their own team's financial and on-field success ahead of the safety and well-being not only of Janae Palmer, but of every woman in this country now threatened by a man who, because of how they covered for Ray Rice, was a little more confident that he can get away with it. I accuse Roger Goodell of conducting a kangaroo court by interviewing Janae Palmer Rice with Ray Rice present, in contradiction of all recommended practices when dealing with victims of domestic abuse, thus virtually guaranteeing that whatever testimony she gave them of the events of February 15th, they had the validity of a video made by a hostage with a gun to her head. Putting Janae Palmer Rice in a position to plead for her husband's career, perhaps at the risk of being beaten again if she failed, that Roger Goodell did. Seek and act upon the videotape that should have sent Rice to jail without bail, that he did not do. Commissioner Goodell, as I first said on this program on August 1st, must resign. If he will not do so, NFL owners must fire him and fire Senior Vice President Birch and Chief Counsel Pash. Pash, of all people, should have known better than to put the victim on trial and to acquit without all the evidence. Mr. Goodell's ineptitude has not merely rendered this football season meaningless and irrelevant by contrast. It has not only reduced supporting or watching NFL football to a distasteful, even a disrespectful act, but most importantly, it has comforted the violent and afflicted the victim. His push to increase NFL punishment of domestic abusers to roughly one-third that of repeat pot smokers, his decision today to suspend Rice indefinitely after the Ravens had fired him, are elements of classic tragedy, wherein the right thing is finally done only after it is too late to matter. Roger Goodell's existence, who he is, what he has turned the NFL commissioner's office into, is now symbolized by Ray Rice's brutal left hand striking Janae Palmer and striking her again. Mr. Goodell is an enabler of men who beat women. His position within the National Football League is no longer tenable. And I accuse Ray Rice of a brutal and potentially deadly assault, followed not by admission and contrition, but by a pious, self-serving, insincere, cynical, devious, manipulative, unapologetic performance to protect his job and his money at the expense of the truth, at the expense of the public, at the expense of the next woman he brutalizes. He has already had his second chance. This new video shows he had already squandered it. Ray Rice must never be allowed back in a National Football League uniform. And lastly, I accuse us, all of us, executives, players, fans, reporters, of failing to draw a line in the sand when one was needed most. Any games played by Baltimore without its executives and the commissioner having been dismissed and without Ray Rice being permanently banned by the National Football League must be fully boycotted by all of us. If not, we become accessories after the fact.
Now, what do you think of that? First, Bernard, what do you think of it?
Dave is right. He's right on the money with that. Right on the money. I agree with everything he said.
But that means that you're a... George, let me ask you before I give my opinion. What do you think of what Keith said?
Listen, Keith can lay it out. Nobody can lay it out like he does. Nobody. They quote. Remember they quote him in the Sarah Palin thing. You know, remember the McCain-Sarah Palin thing? McCain says, I was listening to Keith Olbermann. The guy said, don't listen to Keith Olbermann. You're driving crazy. And it's true. I mean, he lays this thing out. It's like a Shakespearean play. He lays it out. You know, I'm telling you, if you listen to him, you'd go, you'd take a gun and shoot yourself in the head. You wouldn't wait for a trial or a jury. I mean, Keith could lay it out, but he put it, he put the wood to him. He put the wood to him,
now,
I'm telling you.
Now, compare contrast that with what Stephen A. Smith said just a little while ago. I mean, you remember, Stephen A. Smith said, well, he's only 22 years old. He made a mistake. You know, you got to... He didn't even address the idea about what this man did. He made a mistake, you know, he made a mistake. And then to doubly put this on trial, today, before the show started, I was listening to, like I always do, at 12 o'clock for a half hour while I'm having a drink, because that's the only time I can listen to him. And it was 12 o'clock noon. Yeah, I had a drink, 12 o'clock noon, that's right. The thing was...
Drink of water, we got you.
Drink of water, right.
You have.
And the thing was, who else you listen to at 12 o'clock? Rush Limbaugh. He was saying, I am so sick and tired of this mess. He said, who cares? I don't want to hear about that. I couldn't even sit through the football game. I don't listen to the pre-show anymore because it's all about... them. Yeah. Well, he was one of them who wanted to be on a pregame show. And an after show. You remember that? And he got his butt thrown off. Well, he was saying that, hey, who cares about these people getting beat up? All I know is about football. He said, I don't care about them. He said, so they want to beat each other up, so what? They're them anyway. Remember that quote, George, from... what's the favorite trial that we love?
O.J.?
No. The movie trial with Henry Fonda.
12 Angry Men?
12 Angry Men. You remember when the guy says, Henry Fonda told him, well, why are you so upset about that person? Why? Why you don't believe in this woman who says that she saw it through the train? He said, she's one of them, isn't she? Well, this is what Keith Olbermann is saying. He's one of them. Why are we paying attention to that? That's how they act. So this is what it's come to. So Keith did not go in that direction. Keith laid it out the way it was. And if you're this, Ray Rice should be hanging himself right now. But not just Ray Rice. Goodall and everybody else. And you see what they did. They said, oh, don't worry about it. We're going to have this whole thing solved. We now have the former FBI director as the person who is going to supervise it. And, ring the bell, he ain't supervised it because the Myra and Rooney from the Cleveland and New York City are going to oversee Myra. I'm going to oversee Mueller. And if they don't like what Mueller finds, it ain't going to come out. So
yeah, I thought
here
that
we
was
are.
Weird to put two owners that could be involved in, you know, to be the final arbiters of what this report is. That
then
didn't
why do
make
you
much Mueller? Sense.
The only reason why they have Mueller in there is to give it some sort of,
credence.
Because you wouldn't think two owners would give it credence. Because they have, and Mueller's respected. Mueller is now getting paid. And it ain't by the federal government where he is nonpartisan. He's getting paid by people who are partisan, who are partisan to the game. And then we have... do I have this little tidbit here?
Wow.
I have this little tidbit here. Let me see if I can bring this up here. Here's the other thing that people are saying that why... Element, where is it at? Where is it? Did I go past it? I went past it. Okay. This is how independent this little ditty is that the NFL is running now.
Team, how independent will Robert Mueller really be? You've got a couple of owners, a couple of old guard owners, John Mara and Art Rooney II, overseeing the supposedly independent investigation, which necessarily makes it a little less independent than it otherwise would be. And then there are the tentacles between Robert Mueller, his law firm, and the NFL. From the law firm being directly involved in the recent negotiation of the NFL's extension with DirecTV, multiple billion dollars, to a habit of lawyers leaving that firm and going to work for NFL teams, to the fact that Ravens president Dick Katz spent more than 30 years at that firm. Is this the kind of independence
we're really looking for. Is there an appearance that maybe Mueller won't be independent? Because ultimately, the business he's part of relies upon an ongoing relationship with the National Football League. So if Mueller goes in there and he decides that this is an inherently toxic and poisonous situation that needs to be dismantled from the top to the bottom, is he going to be comfortable saying that? Is he going to be comfortable recommending a change in not only commissioner but every other key position that had any role in this ultimate outcome? Makes it awkward, makes it delicate, makes it difficult, makes him not truly independent. You know, the point I've made a few times, if you really want to be independent, go get Paul Tagliabue. He was the commissioner for twice as long as Roger Goodell already has been the commissioner. He knows how things work. He knows how things get to the truth. Have him come in and do it. We've already seen he's independent, even though he had a connection to a law firm that has been funneling employees to leave office for years, Covington and Burling. Tagliabue has proven that he's able to be independent because he was independent 2 years ago when he ultimately scuttled the suspension of the Saints players in the Bounty case.
So, George, could you hear that? Make that out?
Yeah, I could get the gist of it. Basically, that you got people evaluating the thing that it involved, and
right.
You know, have an axe to grind. I mean, they're not going to cut off the hand that feeds them.
No, they're not.
And that's when you want to bring somebody in, you got to really get somebody who has no, you know what I'm saying? Like. Get some ballet dancer or something to evaluate the thing. Somebody who runs a ballet company. Maybe they would, they could come into the football thing and just see. You don't have to know football. You doesn't, you know. They,
no.
People who have hooked up with it, they're. That's not. It doesn't make. They can't. They can't be impartial.
Well,
because it comes back to them
is,
ultimately.
That's just like saying. Well, hey, you never played major league sports, so you could never be a manager. Yeah, in the major leagues. Yeah, well, let me tell you a little story. There was a guy who played one at bat. He had one at bat in the major leagues. One at bat. And was a manager. He's in the Hall of Fame right now, 24 years straight on 1 year contract. The name was Walter Off. He played for the Los Angeles Dodgers. He had one at-bat, and he struck out. So you don't have to be in the same field to operate on an administrative with an administrative format. You don't
right.
have to. Ron Cipolla or this the former commissioner, who's the former commissioner?
NFL?
Yeah, the former, the one that took
Pete Rozelle.
Yeah, you. He can come in right now. He don't have. Hey, he can be paid independently by the NFL and say, "Hey, straighten this out. What's going on here?" But they don't want it straightened out because a lot of them are in the same position. And let me play one of them who's in, might be in the same position right now.
It all started with a series of photos of Cowboys owner Jerry Jones in the company of a group of young women. They hit the internet in early August and quickly spread to papers and blogs nationwide. The images may have raised some eyebrows, but Jones didn't bat an eyelash. Talk about the shots soon fell by the wayside until Tuesday, when the woman who says she took the photos filed suit against Jones and the Cowboys. The document shows she accuses Jones of sexually assaulting her that night of the pictures, sometime in May or June of 2009. She says the aftermath left her with emotional distress and accuses the Cowboys organization of negligence for not keeping her safe from Jones. Finally, she says he and the Cowboys conspired to keep the assault quiet. The victim's name is Jana Weckerly of Ardmore, Oklahoma. Her attorney, Thomas Bowers of Dallas, released her name and is asking for more than $1 million in damages on her behalf. In response to the suit, attorneys for the Cowboys released a strong statement. This is nothing more than an attempt to embarrass and extort Jerry Jones. This is a shakedown by a lawyer who is a solo practitioner just trying to make a name for himself. We intend to vigorously contest this complaint and expect it will be shown for what it is, a money grab. A Damon Allen to say that the claims are so baseless, the Cowboys are getting police involved. Tonight we tried to reach Wimberly and Bowers, who are returning by phone and email. We've not yet heard back, but we'll continue to try.
Now, I like Jerry Jones. Jerry, I'm a Dallas Cowboy fan. I don't think Jerry Jones could, you know, he can do wrong because a lot of things I saw on the field. But I'm telling you, your former stripper or showgirl, whatever the heck she was, Jerry Jones took a picture with her. I saw these pictures, you know, and I'm sure Jerry Jones' wife don't like it. But the problem is, why were you with Jerry Jones in the first place? You know, so, hey, and now the thing is, well, she's got a lawyer who's a solo practitioner. In other words, they didn't want to say ambulance chaser.
Right.
But the problem is, hey, maybe the lawyer's a good guy. I don't know. I can't say anything about lawyer. Maybe the girl's a good guy. But again, I ask, why are you going to be taking a picture with Jerry Jones when you got his ears all over? I mean, these pictures have been out for a long time. And now you're going to sue him? You're going to sue the Cowboys? I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I mean, come on. I don't want to say nothing about this woman because I don't know. All I know is I just like to ask the question. Why? Mr. Gaffney?
I'm not getting involved with this one. I don't know. I haven't heard about this before. So I'm like Roger Goodell. I didn't hear anything about it. I'm going along with Christie and Goodell. I don't know anything about it. See no evil, hear no evil.
So if you saw the film, you would agree with me then. If you saw the videotape replay, then you would agree with me.
Sure. Whatever you say.
So now this is the thing. As you were saying before, George, I can't imagine a videotape coming into the NFL office and them not wanting it to come into the NFL office. This tape didn't just decide, oh, can you put me in an envelope and take me over to the NFL office, please?
Somebody signed for that tape.
Yes, the woman signed for it.
And the
woman signed for it and said, oh, it's really horrible.
Yep.
They had the voice of her saying on the phone that, yes, we
right.
got it. That's the
yes.
that's somebody's voice that you can identify.
Right, exactly right.
So where is this woman now? In Buenos Aires? Where you can't expedite her?
She's on extended vacation.
Yeah, suddenly she's on vacation. They haven't mentioned anything about that. So
next time you hear about her, she'll have Ebola, and she'll die.
Yeah, what was this, like the Pelican Brief?
Yeah.
They're wiping them out.
Absolutely. So now we have a situation that could have been held at the district court level and been a 1 or 2 day story before the NFL season started.
Yep.
Now we've already had nothing during the pregame show about football. We've had nothing about Ray Rice and his fiance, girlfriend, wife now, and what the NFL knew and what they didn't know.
Right.
And now they brought in the former FBI director to seek it out, although he's got a tight leash around his neck from Myra and Rooney.
Well, they made it worse. The NFL made it worse.
They made it worse.
They made it worse.
What's that they always say, George, about the it ain't the story.
The cover up is worse than the crime.
Yep. So
the cover
right.
up is worse than the crime.
Yep.
And they had a little bit of a domestic fight that got really out of hand by the way, before I forget this, did you see yesterday the women wearing Ray Rice's T-shirt marching at the stadium saying, we want Ray Rice. We know he didn't mean it, and we want him. And then the woman got on. The woman, I could not believe this. My wife wasn't here. I almost choked to death. She said, well, she had to do something wrong for him to slap her, for him to punch her like that. This was a woman. I wonder how much money she got paid.
I don't know, but she got something.
She was wearing a Ray Rice T-shirt. She said she must have did something. Because you know how women are. They'll get you upset.
This is what the woman said.
Now, come on.
Like George said, I'm not touching that one either.
I mean, this is completely outrageous. Well,
what you need to do is see what kind of car she's driving today. What did she drive when she came there? What is she driving today?
She took the bus.
A Lamborghini.
Does she have teeth?
But she took the bus and she went home in an Audi. Come on, give me a break here. You know, this is completely outrageous. It is completely outrageous. These people don't care. They will put anybody they want, and they only make it worse. What don't they understand about this, about making things worse? I mean, what don't they understand about this? I mean, it's just outrageous. They make things right, and it deserves a boo. But the thing is, so now we have the NFL distorting all the things that should have been taken care of in the first place. But here's what they distorted everything, the NFL. And I want to play for you what the NFL, if I have it here, and I don't have it here. How come I don't have it here? But anyway, what the NFL is saying about people who are saying things they don't know what they're talking about. But yet, the NFL can say things about anything they want. Now, you were saying to me yesterday, George, or last night about how the NFL has they don't have the same, of course, they don't have the same, they don't have the same people, what do you call it, why am I losing my mind, the same union, give me a break here, they don't have a union. So a lot of these things that would normally come into play, Ray Rice never would have went to court without his union, and nobody in the NFL would have spoken to him without a union rep speaking to him. I mean, is that correct?
Well, nobody has a better union than baseball.
That's right. Oh, absolutely.
So baseball is really unionized.
So the story is that this would not take place in football, I understand, and we talked about before, is the only one where you can actually get away with all this.
Well, what we talked about, remember, too, was the thing about football is what we said. If you sign a contract for $99 million and you break your leg the first game, your contract is null and void. Your contract is based on performing. Now, a baseball player could sign a contract, and he could trip on his way out of the office where he signed the contract and never play again, and he still gets his money. Baseball is your contract is your money. And these other sports, football, it's all theoretical. You have to continue to perform. So it sounds like a guy's getting a lot of money, but if he doesn't perform, they can just fire him tomorrow afternoon.
To avoid
lawsuits and stuff, they usually get you through the medical part of it, get you cured up to a decent level, but they don't have to pay you for the length of your contract if you don't perform.
So
and that's because the union is not as strong as they try to make out they are.
When Ray Rice signed with the Ravens, did he get a signing bonus?
I have no idea.
I believe he did get a signing bonus.
Let's look that up, because I would have to give that back now.
If he got a signing bonus, would this automatically revoke his signing bonus, Judge? What do you think?
I I don't know. I think he probably could keep that money. I would imagine he could keep that money. I don't know. But I would imagine that there's probably something he could keep that money. But he's not keeping that $40 million. I know that.
So we have someone who has a big diamond ring and has to give it back.
Yeah.
Is that what we're saying? Big diamond ring, and she's got to give it back.
Well, I mean, again, I don't know how somebody knocks you out on national television, and this is the person that you're saying, in all the world, this is the right person for you if you didn't look at that money. That she saw that money. I mean, you know, and I don't blame her. Like, but
she had burgundy panties on.
Brother, I was looking that close.
I saw it 15 times on TV.
Nice thighs.
One shoe
by a head. It says that he's likely to keep his $25 million.
That was his signing bonus?
I'm going to let you know right now. I'm pulling it up. It says Ray Rice likely to keep $25 million.
Oh,
so let's see if that was
I'm thinking about going down there and seeing if he wants to have a new brother-in-law or something. I mean, I didn't know he was keeping any kind of money like that.
I
thought his signing bonus would be like a couple hundred thousand.
Well, but you see, but it's only $12 million, George, $12.5 million, because $12.5 million is going to us.
Oh, well,
okay.
Then that's not worth it. Then I'm not going to bother myself for $12.5 million. I have some TV shows I want to watch. It's unbelievable. I'm telling you, what you need to show on is about how these athletes throw away this money. I mean, did you see the thing about the 10 brokest players in the NBA are all black players that signed contracts for $60 and $70 million in their career or more, you know, their career earnings and no less than $70 million, and these guys are bankrupt.
Look at Mike Tyson.
Now this is basketball players. Is, you know, besides Mike Tyson they said $400 million past his contracts totaled $400 million, and he ended up broke. You know, he's still out there, but, I mean, he's hustling now. But it's unbelievable. I always talk about Alonzo Mourning, that when he signed his contract with the Hornets or whatever, the first thing he did was buy a $72,000 wristwatch.
What the? What is
a Timex has got the same exact time as a $72,000 wristwatch. It was the first thing he bought.
Crazy. That's crazy.
Well, that's because he can't. Well, wait a minute. No, that wasn't there. Because I was going to say when. Was he there at. No, that wasn't. I'm trying to think. $72,000 wristwatch. That's because he can't tell time and the wristwatch talks to him and tells him time.
$72,000. It ought to reverse time. Go back and make the day. Go back and give you another chance to do everything. But I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Well, you know, we were talking about this this AP story that said no one knew about the video. Let me just play you something here.
About domestic violence as a whole, as an epidemic, as a human being towards another human being, and not turned into. You know, athletes are violent people.
A high-ranking NFL source tells TMZ no one at the league saw the Ray Rice elevator video until TMZ Sports posted it Monday. Up to now, the NFL has hedged, saying to their knowledge no one in the organization got the tape. But now an NFL source tells us in no uncertain terms, no one at the league got it. And the source goes on to define the league as three things. NFL headquarters, NFL Films in New Jersey, and the NFL Network in L.A. The source goes on to say the NFL headquarters has around 475 employees at its New York City headquarters, and no one at these three offices saw it.
Yes, but who signed for the tape?
Yeah, who said it was horrible?
That's right. I mean, who was it? Oh, it must have been Ray Rice's wife.
Could have been.
she
well,
said
maybe
it
they
was
meant
horrible.
Maybe they meant if we could see it, it's probably horrible.
Oh.
Maybe that was the original quote.
Okay. So it's a matter of English here. That's what it's a matter.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, the thing is, did you come up with that?
No, it just says that football's Ray Rice will probably get to keep about $25 million that he's been paid from the Ravens. So that's $25 million.
So has he gotten any of his money already?
It says he's going to keep it.
No, but has he gotten it or any of it, like $1, $5, $10?
No, it doesn't say. It doesn't say.
So she has to wait then until.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, he's been paid. That's it. $25 million. He's been paid. So
oh,
that's the money he already has.
Oh, okay. So if he didn't put it in offshore account, she can get it.
Maybe.
So, well, hey. Well, maybe she. See, I don't want to say that she is a little bit greedy.
No, she loves him. You know what she said?
I love him. She loves him. And he's now. Do they have any children? Do they?
No. No. At least I haven't seen that.
Thank goodness, because you know that would be a major story. And as short as he is, he can't go into basketball. So, well. What have we? Let's wind this up here, George. I want you to tell us first. What have you learned today about this since you've been on the air? About everything. You take anything you want.
What I've learned is that this guy Ray Rice is very lucky. If I had hit my wife at any time, my father-in-law would have been there in 5.5 seconds. I'd be a dead man. So he's very lucky on that account. My father-in-law would not. There's no way. You know my father-in-law. There's no way I would be alive if I touched my wife. So I tell you, he's lucky he didn't marry into that family.
Not on this planet. Uncle Donald would have been there. It's been all over. Well,
it would have been all over. You never. They'd never find the body.
Never.
I just. Oh,
never
George left town.
In a hurry.
That's it.
He
crossed the George Washington Bridge. We saw
exactly.
Last time we saw George, he was crossing the George Washington Bridge.
Ask Chris Christie.
He was walking.
He was walking. Well, what have you learned?
Well, what I've learned today was your vote does count. How can we get a sitting senator lose the election by 21 votes? That's outrageous. So
or fraud.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to use the F word, but yeah, fraud. So people, our votes count. They count.
Well, I'll tell you what I learned. I learned that. Bernard's a very good co-host. Right, that's what I want to hear. That's
thank you, sir.
First thing. And George knows a lot. You know, he's just not a movie man.
Oh, okay.
He was a teacher for 55 years. Oh, was it 37 years.
38.
Okay. And he knows what these little mongrels, I mean, these little students, these children are doing. I'm just trying to be facetious. How they will be when they grow up, because he can see it in the classroom. And this is not, I'm only kidding about students. I know the thing is, when I taught school, students didn't care if you knew jack about the subject. All they want to know is whether or not you came in the classroom and treated them fair. If you treated them fair, that's 75% of teaching kids in class. And they will come to you and say, hey, Mr. Gaffney, Mr. Lawson, Mr. Rowe, I have a problem here. They want someone to talk to, because a lot of times these kids have no one to talk to at home. And they look up to their teacher. And you can go back and you can always remember your favorite teacher. And you can say, you know, ask you why you remember that favorite teacher, and it's always something very simple. Like mine, I remembered my favorite teacher. Her name was Eleanor Wissenhouse. Absolutely gorgeous. I was in love with her. That's why I remember her. English class. And she, I was sitting at her desk.
What grade was she in?
Freshman in high school. And
yeah.
She sat right there. This is her first year teaching. Redhead, beautiful, gorgeous shape. She used to sit with beautiful legs. She would sit right there on the edge of the table and cross her legs and raise and ask the question. And I would put up two hands. And I would always give the right answer. So at our first open house, my mother and father came up. And see, I was very quiet to go to school. That's when I opened up. And she made me open up. And at first, my mother and father came up to open house. And she says, oh, so how is Mike? Oh, Mike is very good. But you know, I'm going to have to stop asking him questions. I'm going to put his chair in the back of the room. So I was there with her. I said, no. She said, well, because Michael, you don't give the children, the other kids in the class, a chance to answer any questions. So I said, no, I won't ask any questions. Just don't change my seat.
Mm.
And she said, okay. Mm. So now, what it also brought out to me was that she, because I used to stutter when I was a kid. I mean, I stuttered up to the eighth, to my freshman year in high school. And she got me out of stuttering. And, of course, I didn't want to ever change my seat because she was so good.
And what high school was it?
Wingate High School.
Wingate.
And,
hey, today.
Yeah, that's right. And George went to Wingate, too.
You did?
He most certainly did.
Okay, cool.
So you remember Eleanor Wiskowski, George?
No, I heard the name, but I never had her, and I wouldn't be able to describe her. But I saw her name on, you know, some of the I saw her name somewhere in the school, and I remember hearing her name, but I can't put a face on it.
I can see her right now in front of me. I will never forget the teacher. And then I was in love with her. And then I had her for the freshman year, sophomore year, junior year, and then senior year, I looked on the roster and I didn't have her as a teacher. I said, yeah, what's going on? I went down to the guy's house. I got to get her. Mr. Bloom, get me out of here. I want to go to Eleanor. She's still here. She's here. Where's she at? Oh, she's no longer Whiskey and Towski. She married Mr. Freeman. The history teacher. Mr. Freeman, who looked like,
you don't know what.
Hey. I don't know, he might be listening. But you look like, let's see, who's the guy? Elmer Fudd. But anyway, I could not believe it. Broke my heart. I saw her in the class. I saw her walking down the hallway because we had a big building. It was called the Circle Building. We'd walk around the circle. And I saw her. I said, Michael, man, I didn't want to speak to her. She broke my heart.
Well, she married Mr. Freeman.
Of all people, she could have had me. She might have married Mr. Freeman. Because she was very young. She was only like 22.
Right.
Even though I was only 13. But hey, what is the difference of 7 years?
There's laws.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, the laws, they made those laws after.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's our story today. And but that's what I learned. That, you know.
Well, Mikey, let me just throw in one thing. I had one of the, I can't remember her name now, but I had a Spanish teacher. And she was so beautiful. We used to just sit there, me and the guys in class, we'd just sit there and look at her. We didn't care about learning anything. We didn't learn anything. It didn't matter. We just loved her. Some new guy came in the classroom and was giving a hard time. As soon as the bell rang, five of us went over to this guy and told him he is a dead number. We'd beat him worse than Ray Rice would beat him if he said, we don't give this. He said, because if you bother her, she may take a day off. We don't want her to be absent. We want her here every day. This woman was wonderful, beautiful to look at, nice personality. We wanted her there. We didn't learn any Spanish. We didn't care. But we told this guy, said, you can't come. And he gave her a hard time the first day, and we told him. And this wasn't organized. Five of us went over to him independently and told him, don't make this woman stay home because, you know, you give her a hard time. And he never said another word in the bed. And then after a while, he saw the big picture. And he mixed in with us. He saw the light.
She was the teacher
of the class. I mean, I didn't care what she said. It was fine. If there had been a fire, there would have been five of us fighting to rescue her.
Well, you know, yes, that was great. Eleanor Wissing-Towsky was my greatest experience in high school. Well, one of my greatest experiences.
Well, you became an adult. Did you look her up?
She's not Wissing-Towsky anymore. She's Friedman. There's 20 million Friedmans in New York City. Well, are you kidding me? There's no way I could find her.
Okay.
And let's see, how old would she be now? It still wouldn't make a difference. I will always, if you're listening, Eleanor Wissing-Towsky, I still remember what you looked like, your first teaching experience at Wingate High School.
In Brooklyn.
I'm Michael Lawson. You can never forget me, but I sat right by the desk where you used to cross your legs. Gorgeous legs. I meant to tell you that, but I didn't. But I thought it every day. But anyway, so we learned quite a lot today. And
Go back and mention Judge Trotter's name and everything like that before you go on.
I'm going to do that. We also learned, and, you know, it's unsolicited. I just asked a simple question. But we found out from Yolanda Trotter, who's running for a district court in New York, in Mecklenburg County. Yes, Judge Trotter. Did I say Judge Trotter?
No, you said Trotter.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, Yolanda. It's Yolanda M. Trotter.
Right.
We learned today that what a judge needs to do, the clarity of it is so incredible, how she painted this picture of what a judge should do, how temperament in the courtroom is not like what you see on TV. It is just TV, remember? It's TV. No matter what they say, they plan out how they're going to operate with these people. Those judges look at these case files before they get out there. Because, you know, when they come out, they say, okay, just give us a little, it's almost like a closing argument when they come out and they got people in front of them. Because they already know the case. Because I believe, don't these cases have to go to a regular trial first, and then they choose whether to go on TV or go through the court system? That's how it's done.
I don't understand.
What happens is that these judges on TV, they go to various courts.
Yeah, but the judges on TV, that's just for TV. That's reality TV.
No. But it's actually, that's how the case is finalized. They do that.
It's like reality TV. Those people are paid. Those people are paid.
Oh, yes, right. They're paid to go in there, but whatever the judge comes up with is their thing.
Right.
So the thing is, she, Yolanda Trotman, I mean, put it in no uncertain terms what the job of a district court judge is and how it should be. And the job is, first of all, temperament, how she takes and considers the case. And it's not like it is on TV where it's quick draw McGraw.
Court's very boring, actually. It's very quiet. It's very, very boring.
It's only boring for the people sitting there, but you're up there in front of them.
Oh, no, it's not boring.
It's sweat bullet. But Judge, and I'm going to call her Judge Trotman, she will be the next district court judge here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg County, and very shortly after that, we might be presenting you as next Supreme Court justice in the state of North Carolina. So,
nice.
Everybody look out for Yolanda Trotman, because she's coming your way in this state as the next Supreme Court justice, after she hits by this little bump in the road.
Yeah. Call an election.
Well, all right. I want to thank everybody. I want to thank Mr. Bernard Rowe, Vice President of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg, North Carolina Black Leadership Caucus. And thank you, Mr. George Gaffney. Big Gaff, always grateful to hear from you. And I hope to hear from you again. Matter of fact, when more comes on about this case, I want you back on the line, Big Gaff, and tell us. And matter of fact, you need to get an interview. You haven't done a review interview, a review on your latest film.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Yeah, you have to do that. Okay. I want to thank you, everybody. This is Friday. The weekend's coming, and it's finally sunny in Charlotte.
Indeed.
After six days. But well, we're supposed to get 4 inches of rain between now and Monday.
Give me a break.
All right, everybody. Have a good weekend. And since the NFL has such drastic powers, maybe we need to get Mr. Elliot Ness involved.